Hello, everyone, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap, October the 18th of 2017. I'm sorry, I stumbled there because a robot, an evil haunted robot, tried to distract me.
It's the evil of the iPhone Corporation, Meek! Ooh!
I believe that, yes.
Where is my cell phone now? Oh, no! It's here. Wait, don't worry about it.
Hold on, I need to dial a number. One.
Two. Oh, I have like the old ass cell phone too, where I had to hit like a number six times to get to a C.
Oh, I went for rotary phone. Oh. Full mile cell phone.
Both would be equally as awful to have the count narrating his time through, so.
Oh, man. Welcome, everybody, to the continuation of Halloween month. We're about halfway through the month of October, and we have more spooky series.
Whoa! Imagine, if you will, an island of beautiful women, but all of them want to kill you.
Because they're zombies. I forgot that part. Do you think this is racist to Romanians? Like, do you think they hear the count and they're just like, fuck this guy. Like, fuck him.
Well, I mean, it was based off of Bela Lugosi's Dracula character, so.
So it's cool? Like, we can all claim that, like, we're not being insensitive? We're all just basing this off the one bad impression?
Well, and also, Bela Lugosi was Hungarian. He wasn't Romanian.
All right, I feel good then.
So the Romanians just like, no, it's cool!
They're like, we love this guy!
They just all turn into the count. This is the offensive stereotype.
Why you do
Let
this?
Let us count the number of ways it is problematic.
One, two.
So yeah. Well, Chris, it was bound to happen sooner or later. Where we got into that other aspect of Halloween series beyond just the spooky things and the monsters to the random sexuality of Halloween as well. I still don't really quite get where the connection comes from. I don't know why people went from like, oh, we should wear masks and give candy to children, to like, all of our women should dress as slutty as possible. But here we are. And there are multiple manga that do combine that, even if they're not specifically Halloween themed, because Japan doesn't really do Halloween the same way that we do, there are quite a few examples combining body horror and just boobs, I guess because mature audience, question mark?
Well, that's the thing. Like, you notice that most of the, excuse me, when the body or the torture porn genre really hit America that way, a lot of those featured, like, super attractive women in the lead roles. Now, granted, that's also just Hollywood in general. Mm-hmm. You know, they always want attractive, like, female lead in there. But there's something, I don't know where it is. It sticks to some level of depravity in there. But there does seem to be some element of, like, body horror stuff that wants to see attractive people get it as well, I guess. I don't know. It's a genre that literally just defies my comprehension of things.
I don't know any more about it than you do, so. Anyway. You know anything about Resident Evil, Biohazard?
I know.
I've never played any of the games. Any of them.
I know a bit about the franchise. The main thing I know is I played Resident Evil 4 all the way through. Resident Evil's a or 4 is a fantastic game.
One of the good ones, so.
It is supremely good. It has a weird end to it. It's one of those things that just kind of exists, I guess, in the Resident Evil universe where it starts off horror focused, like you're this one guy running around this entire town of like Spaniard people who have all been turned, and it just feels like claustrophobic and there's monsters everywhere. And then at the end, you're like running through ancient laboratories and you're fighting like guys shooting missiles at you, and you're like, this is a weird, like, where, like, a couple hours ago, I was terrified of a guy with a pitchfork, and now there are flamethrower spider people coming after me. But oddly enough, the entire game works well enough that you don't really notice it so much. You're right. I apologize. It's not Spain. I forget exactly where they were. but I thought it was somewhere in the general Eastern European region. Regardless, I know a bit, you know, obviously I played that one, and I know some general lore from most of the other games. I know 5 and 6 weren't incredibly well received, and then 7 went right back to being like, alright, you're trapped in a haunted house, shut up now, you don't have to fight, like, super baddies anymore. So it went right back to kind of being more horror, but, Resident Evil is this weird series that combines horror but has a very elaborate government, like, conspiracy plot as the backdrop for it. So a lot of their series have to tend to include that, which basically says by the end of the story, you are going to be demystified to the entire horror experience, because now we have to have, like, a cackling mad scientist explain all of the scientific reasons behind this.
Which kind of takes away the mystification of it and the, more humanizes it, I guess you could say.
Yeah. But, we can kind of easily say that's sort of what happens in this series as well. Because for a series that started off as essentially being a slasher fic,
this series really was.
This series eventually does have to become like, all right, so here's why the Umbrella Corporation's on this island. Here's what they're attempting to do. They've got this, like, super laboratory where they can restrain the biohazards if they need to, or their bioweapons. You know, we can keep them locked down here, and there's a super spy element now coming into it. Also in a bikini. And, you know, then we'll have soldiers come down and start killing these things. And I guess you can't, like, if you're a huge fan of the Resident Evil franchise, you're probably like, I like that, or you're at least like, I'm okay with that. But that is something I guess maybe is unique about this sort of franchise to most other ones. It'd be like if a Friday the 13th movie always end with, like, a Freddy Krueger SWAT team task force showing up at the scene, and they're just like, nobody go to sleep! Nobody go to sleep! Alright, now we're gonna chloroform one person and just stick a bunch of knives on you, so that way if Freddy Krueger tries to attack you, he gets stabbed. Alright, this always works. We're trained soldiers. Oh god, it's not working! He's gotten stronger! Like, it's just how those certain things
work. And now he has all those knives!
Oh, what fools we were!
He shows up in somebody's dream, and instead of just, like, the one knife glove, he's got, like, knives hanging everywhere. He's got, like, knives for teeth. he's way less funny and clever when he can't really, you know, emote to that.
Oh, way, yeah. Though. They took everything fun away from Freddy Krueger, and now you're just like...
You just replace it with sharp edges.
Now you just sit there like, oh, man, this is just a fucking child pedophile with a sweater. I don't like this anymore.
It's really kind of, almost a best hits kind of series for all of those, kind of horror movies that you could get. There is the slasher element. There's the, you know, cause, you know, it's primarily a bunch of mostly naked women who are the victims, and there is a seemingly immortal guy in a mask stalking our heroes. There is more typical, zombie elements of it, with, you know, just, oh, everyone's getting infected, and there are people who hide their infections when they first discover them, and there's, for whatever reason, just one guy who's super, super good at fighting zombies, and there's no way of escaping because they're on an island, and all of their methods of transportation are disabled, all of their methods of communicating outside of the island are destroyed.
What's,
then there's a cult horror element too, because there's a weird kind of voodoo thing going on as well.
I think we should explain what the premise of this is for everybody who maybe doesn't know. So this is, as we said,
what are these guys talking about? And why is there a picture of Claire Redfield in a bikini over them?
Well, that's a good question. Our title card artist. So the series is based in the Resident Evil universe. And to my knowledge, I've heard this is canon. Claire Redfield's in it. Also, Chris Redfield shows up in kind of like a cameo at one point. The Umbrella Corporation's involved, as well as, I'm going to forget the name of it, but like Shanghua Pharmaceuticals or something along those lines. They're involved with it as well. So there's ties to the Resident Evil universe, but the original plot for this series is that there is a idol competition show. Essentially, if you took I guess just any kind of idol show and combined it with like Survivor plus The Amazing Race. I'm not really sure because they're obviously not forced to live on the island and complete destitute. They're just like show up on the island and run races and things to be eliminated. They just send them out to the fucking forest at one point. They're like, find cards. Like, what? This seems highly dangerous. Did you guys like vet this island ahead of time to make sure it's not dangerous animals? Like,
you shut up and get your bouncy bits moving into that jungle.
there's legitimately a moment, and this actually is hugely plot relevant because this essentially becomes the way the heroes survive things.
Right. It's Chekhov's pit.
They dig a pit at the start of this that is easily at least 6 or so feet deep, probably even deeper, and are like, that we'll just cover this up. And then when some of the women,
a Burmese tiger trap.
Yeah. And like, and when some of the model, like the idols are running along, they'll fall into the hole and be out of the competition. I was like, yeah, and they might break their fucking leg. You just put a 6 foot tall, like tall sheer drop that they're not expecting in the middle of this obstacle course. I don't know. They also, apparently they have, it was probably what, like 30 idols or something like that, maybe 20. And apparently each individual,
absurd number of them, yeah.
Each idol has their own individual cameraman to follow them around using a handheld cam recorder too, which just seems foolish. And they're just sent off on this island. They're like, just do it. Yeah. Like,
and here we are in the jungle, guys. Look at that action.
Look at those tits. Oh, I can't see them. Well, I'm telling you, it's great. Yeah, they also talk to their person as well. Like the girls are like actively communicating with their cameraman. It's just like, I don't think you're supposed to do that in reality shows. I think we're supposed to be separated from the idea that there's someone behind the camera, but whatever. So that's like the premise of it. And then obviously there's a zombie element to it. There's this tribe that lives on the island. They have some connection with these dark kind of occult rituals that have been creating these creatures. The one we see never is really fully named. He's nicknamed Mordio at one point, but it's essentially this hulking beast, kind of a little bit like Nemesis, if you're a fan of the Resident Evil franchise. But he wears like this big trench coat. He has like this tiki mask on that covers most of his face. You just kind of see like the bare teeth underneath. And then he carries around like a harpoon and an anchor. And that's like our slasher villain for most of this series, because he's the one who's kind of going through the woods hunting women. And then sometimes those women like survive, or not survive, but they're like left around to just be like wandering zombies that cause chaos. But other times he takes them with them to a purpose that's never fully actually explained.
He's trying to make a village, Chris.
Yeah. I guess he just has that insane notion. The zombies, like, when they get to the village, like, I guess that'll be Zombie Baker then. Like, I feel like they just walk around and try to escape to eat more people. He's just like, oh, dude, come back. Yes, that is true, Josh. It is like Nemesis, a lowland version, like from the new Pokemon Sun and Moon games. But I actually like that aspect of the series a lot because here's the thing. We talked about in the show that when we do Halloween month, it's kind of humorous because neither Nick or I really enjoy horror that much. But I will say, contrary, that I do love slasher movies. I love the ones that have like the cool villain to it. Like I love the Freddy Krueger, the Jason Voorhees, you know, the Mike Myers, Pinhead, all those like cool villainous, like serial killer villains from movies. I always have thought like are kind of cool. And this dude fits right into that mold because he's not too goofy. Like, he fits an aesthetic to that island that works, and then you just see him essentially hurling harpoons into people and killing them and, like, slashing people with anchors and shit. It's kind of goofy, but it works.
He uses the anchor as a grappling hook at one point. It's weird.
It is absurd at points, but, you know, I liked his design. I thought it was kind of cool, and that aspect when it does just feel like a horror movie and he's just going around killing people is kind of cool. Unfortunately, that changes really quickly because they introduce in the first 2 chapters, so I want to say like a little less than 24 like named characters, and we're like, okay, these will be like our cast, and obviously a couple of them are going to get killed off pretty quickly. Like all of them get killed off very quickly. There's like a director on the island, a producer on the island, a comedian on the island. All of them are killed so quickly. The director, I was stunned at how quickly he got killed and how unceremonious it was. It was just like him like, hey, what's going on out there?
Why are you out there?
And I'm like, why did we name this guy? Like, it's not like you needed a death. You killed like three other characters in this chapter. What's the point of the director?
Well, and also there's the fact that they set up their, you know, like 30 different bikini model grab your idol girls. And three of them survived the initial onslaught, I think.
Yeah, well, that's actually
three.
Yes, they do make mention of calling out five of them before it, and that's sort of the five we're meant to take stock in. One of them, I don't think, does anything, and one of them gets killed in that competition, becomes a zombie, which kind of triggers a lot of like the new, oh my god, what's happening here? What's this zombie on the island doing? And the other three last are essentially major characters going on through it. And we eventually get to this point where there's a core group of characters. And you know what? I do feel like I need to applaud this series in some regard, because there's a cover page on chapter 29, and it shows the seven principal characters who are still left at that time. And of those seven, six of them are female characters. And the only male character left, Tomonaga, I think is his name. He's sort of like
80. Whatever.
80, yeah. He's sort of the protagonist of this series because he's the only, like, original character of that point. Like, Claire Redfield's shown up at this point, and there's also Inez, who is, like, her protege. Don't worry about it. She's not canon. She also dies. Well, I guess she's canon technically, but she dies in this and only exists in this, to my knowledge. But of that, like, group of seven, the only male character in it is, like, the fourth most actual useful member of the group. So I was like, that's pretty, like, hey, you know what? This is progressive in its own way. Well, I know half the cast like are in bikinis,
three,
but
like,
say.
Soldiers there with them. Yeah. Although this is a kind of weird series because humans are apparently just super powerful on their own. Like just the kinds of people that you would not expect to be capable of running for long periods of time, fighting zombies hand to hand. Like one of the first things that Tominaga does in this series is he goes basically toe to toe with Morio, our serial slasher character guy. And he doesn't like physically overpower him, but he pulls some insane physical stunts in order to get rid of him, because he basically, manages to leverage the guy's harpoon chain and pull them both over a cliff. And then, but he's tied a rope around his waist, so he's like, yes, I caught myself, and you're falling into the ocean. And the guy's like, throws his anchor up like a grappling hook. It's like, okay, I've got to get back up. So Tominaga's like, okay, and kicks off of the cliff and kicks the anchor out. So the guy falls. And it's like, he was just saying, literally like the previous chapter prior to this, that he never gets into fights and he's not like physically fit.
There is, I don't know if it's just, I assume it's just bad writing, but there is an element that like Resident Evil exists in a world of like almost like superhero people. Like they're not actually superheroes. I don't think there's anything that's like reasonably meant to explain that like Leon Redfield or not Redfield, Leon, whatever the fuck his last name is, or Chris Redfield. That's one. Like, I don't think they're meant to have anything in them that makes them more than just dude who has like experience fighting zombies, but they do superhuman shit all the time. There's like people were posted about it in the chat. Chris Redfield punches a boulder into pieces at one point in one of the series. Like, it's just almost like very goofy, kind of over the top stuff. But you don't have that inclination going into this because he spends so much time. Tomonaga is a bitch. I hate this guy. I fucking hate this loser because he's the protagonist of the series. And they spend so much of it focusing on this idea of like, Tomonaga, you gotta fucking like get your shit together because you're gonna
you
have to
protect
these
the girls.
And it's like, he protects none of them basically for so much of the series.
Hey, he protects one of them.
Yeah, he protects the one he has a crush on basically. And he gets
hashtag doesn't fail to protect all of them.
Yeah. He's like, what? I got so many people to protect. There's a point where the person
not
who's telling
all
us
of
this,
the women die.
Yeah. He's telling us this from a guy called Brown, who is like somebody who just has experience fighting zombies. And the guy's like, you gotta do this, you know, you gotta grow up into being a man. And I'm like, motherfucker, you Frenched a chick and gave her the T-virus, you motherfucker! How are you holding yourself on the moral high ground?
Wait, did he? Did that?
Yes, that got that one chick got the fucking T-virus off of that.
That's how she gets zombified at the end. Yeah. Oh, okay. I haven't read entirely all of this manga, to be clear with you guys. I completely forgot about it and read through it as much as I could.
It's like there's a lot of weird, stupid moments like that. And we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the second bioorganic weapon, which I don't know if they ever give any kind of cute nickname to, but he's a fucking, it's just a giant dude who has propellers for hands, which is cool
like
for
boat motors.
It's cool for one moment, and then every other moment you're like, man, it'd be so much better if this thing didn't have fucking motor, like propellers for hands. Like essentially there's supposed to be things it's like hands are locked into, because one gets knocked off at one point and he has free arms after that. But otherwise it's like, I don't think this is anywhere near as cool as the creators thought it was. Like, because nobody.
Just crazy for that moment where he cuts a guy in half vertically, and then it's just like, oh well, I guess I'm stuck with these for the rest of the series.
Yeah, he's like, fuck. All right, I got a couple of cool things. By the way, I meant to ask this to somebody, but I forgot to do it in time. However, there's a point where several people are fighting a propeller guy, and they are trained soldiers, and they fire bullets at him, and he blocks them with his propeller. And I feel like every one of those people is like, I should stop doing this, because if he's blocking with propellers, isn't that just going to send the bullets flying off and like ricocheting in wildly different directions?
It would be completely random directions at that point, probably.
I was like, maybe we should stop shooting at him when we know he could just easily block them with his giant propeller arms. And one character actually fucking boxes this guy too. It's a very goofy series in that way, where you're just like, there's a character that you're like, I can get past, if I get past his giant propeller arm, I'll be inside of his guard, and I'll just box him down. And you're like, all right, it works too, for the most part. Like, she gets in, she starts giving him 1-4, and then, you know, she gets knocked away.
It's one of those kinds of things where it's not so much a horror manga, so much as it is an action series in a horror setting. Which I think is a lot of what some Resident Evil games are. I know that a lot of them did end up going back to more just a proper survival horror thing than like making you feel invincible in an army of zombies. But it really feels as though it's like you're controlling one of many different characters who is just for some reason insanely good at combat. Like, you know, you can imagine certain scenes of this in a Left 4 Dead 2 level, and Yeah.
There's a couple of things I just wanted to note, because I took a couple of notes while reading this. One thing I enjoy is our protagonist's reason for admiring Mayu, which is the gravure idol he likes, is because during a previous photo shoot, they were like, oh, we booked this for like an indoor shoot, but we lost the venue, so now it has to be outdoor shoot and it's cold out. And my
fuck you, like, Tominaga, how did you overlook this?
That's like, he's the cameraman. I don't think
is he, not his responsibility.
Yeah, I was like, he just shoots things. You clearly he's so low on the pecking order it doesn't matter. But like Mayu's response to that was like, okay, well, let's do it anyway. And he was like, I love her. I was like, yeah, dude, she was doing her job. It's like, what was she gonna say? Like, no, fuck you.
I mean, she had a good attitude about it, you know, good for her.
Yeah. Like, I was like, I don't know if that's the entire, like, if you're trying to tell me, like, I don't really admire her for her physical attributes so much as her award-winning personality. It's like, dude, she just agreed to, like, continue working in slightly adverse conditions at the time. I don't really know if that's, like, it's not like she saved a baby from a fire.
There is definitely a certain degree of wish fulfillment in this series, considering that Tominaga is the protagonist and one of the survivors, and roughly 10 chapters in, when Mayu was panicking, she basically says, like, if you protect me, then you can do whatever you want with me. And he's like, you don't need to promise me that. I will protect you anyway. And then at the end, they end up kissing and going on a date. They're like, right, yeah, the nice guy won. Yay, he got the date with
him. He's also a big nerd, too. Yeah. You get that in there too, because he's also like, he has surprisingly good survival instincts, and it's just because he watched a lot of zombie movies.
That's such a weird element of this. Is this a thing in the main Resident Evil series that people like reference zombie stuff? Because it's weird that you have a zombie outbreak in a universe and then you are referencing zombies.
That's
also
like the big Walking Dead thing, is they'll never use the word zombie. So all
because it's a world where, you know, zombies, knowledge of zombies does not exist prior to the zombie outbreak.
Yeah, I feel like it's either one thing you have to do, you have to go into completely, and you're like, it's almost like a parody element where you're like mm-hmm. a zombie land or something like that, where they're like, yeah, there are rules to when zombie outbreaks happen. We already know them because we watched all these zombie things. Or you can't do it, and all the characters have to go in fresh. But he's just like, I watched a bunch of fucking zombie movies, so I know how to, like, create traps and, you know, like, do all these things. And there's, all right, so there's one moment in this I also need to discuss, and that involves, I want to say her name is Tara. This is one of the few names I did not take down. I took down so many. I took down the name of the director thinking he was going to be important. Matthew Espinosa. He did nothing. He died. But it's the American gravior model. I'm going to blank on her name. I'm just going to call her Tina at this point because I legitimately can't remember her name at this moment. She's the one who got Frenched.
Emily.
There you go. So she got Frenched and had the T-virus passed on to her, but it takes a long time before it actually comes up. So there was this big moment when Brown died. Basically, he was halfway through turning and slightly resisting it. I've never actually seen it where, like, literally half of their face has become, like, zombified.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, and he's just like, do it! But Tomonaga couldn't at that moment. He had the gun up to him. And Brown's like, next time, like, you're going to have to do it with your own will. And basically pulls the trigger for Tomonaga and kills himself. So you're like, okay, there's going to be a point later on when Tomonaga is going to have to do this. And that happens with Emily. Emily finds out she's turning, runs away from the group, terrified of what's going to happen. Tomonaga finds her and she's like, I don't want to die alone. I don't want to die a monster. Please let me die as a human. So he puts the gun to her head and that whole reference comes back and he's like, all right, he has to put her down. But he's like, no, I'm not going to kill any one of my friends. So she runs off crying and gets turned into a zombie who then, I guess, thankful that
I
she...
I still remember being a gravior idol. I'm going to strike a sexy zombie pose to end the series. End this shot on my decaying corpse in a bikini.
That's not it, Nick, because there's a thing that happens in between that. So there's a point then where Julie, who is another bikini model, who is also an international super spy.
Is she the hip cocking girl?
Yes.
Or,
yeah, okay. The hip. She's the one.
Every single time she shows up in frame, and she's just like,
Yeah, she's got her hip out. Every one of them. And there's this moment where she's turned out to be evil and she's basically holding the rest of the characters captive and she's like ready to kill them. And she's like hanging Tomonaga over this giant chasm and just hitting him with a baseball bat in the fucking stomach because she's just evil like that. The bitch can kill people by poking their eyes out, as we found out earlier, but whatever. And out of fucking nowhere, I guess, remembering her cause to, like, thankful to Tomonaga for letting her not die then and letting her live on, perhaps in time infinite as a zombie, Emily comes out of nowhere, zombie Emily, and, like, dive tackles Julie and, like, hurls her over the side and kills her, preventing her from killing the rest of the group. Although, ultimately, Julie just injects herself with this super zombie virus and becomes a monster. But, like, the fact that he didn't kill Emily is meant to be like a heroic thing, and it's like, no, you don't. She's never going back. There's never a cure in these things. She doesn't get saved. And the, as you said, the end of the series is like she shows up on the beach like still zombified and shit. You're like, so she's just another disaster waiting to happen? Like, that's so fucked up and sad. Tomonaga, you bitch, just kill her, help her out. It's very strange. You know what? I, despite having some critical issues with the series, I think I still had fun reading it. It's one of those things that I guess maybe doesn't take itself too seriously because there's so many monsters in it. Like, it's the only series where, like, the, like, slasher villain's weakness is a rocket launcher. Like, it's never as simple as just like a really big artillery weapon, but that's what does the villains in this, basically. And I
second straight series this month that involves use of rocket launches as the ultimate solution in a zombie apocalypse.
But that's what I like about it, I guess. Look, this isn't something that you read into for a lot of like deep like critical thinking. It's not something like The Walking Dead, even, where you're like, well, there's like really interesting narrative characters. There's none in this. Like, everybody's either one note or no notes. There is no note to Mayu. She is just a grab your idol.
Oh my!
I don't think she has a personality trait beyond that.
She is just the thing to be protected, basically. She saved Tobinaga in the end. Whatever.
And you know, the slasher part of it, I think, is where I enjoy the series the most. There's a twist that actually comes out as to who, like, the person who was the slasher villain was, gets revealed. And it's incredibly, it's basically told to you immediately, like, 25 chapters in, and they just don't have the characters react to it until much, much later, when they have to be like, oh my god, it was this guy? And you're like, yeah, of course it was. It's the only other person you fucking referenced from this stupid village. There's no one else it could be. And, you know, there's just moments of weird writing like that. Like, the producer of the island was also a super evil person who dies immediately. I don't know what he was going for.
No. Here's the part that I really don't understand. Because you just said that Julie was a super spy too.
Yes.
There's a scene early on, it's just a little bit before you learn that the producer is actually a super evil spy who basically wants to go to where this zombie experiment was taking place so that he can take control of it. But the scene that you see them prior to that is that they're hanging out on the cruise ship, and it's right before Morio goes on the ship and sabotages everything, allegedly. And so he's like, Julie, I need you to pose nude for me, because if you want to get some jobs in this world, you have to do this for people sometimes, you know, being the stereotypical creepy guy. And so then it's revealed, oh, he's actually this evil super spy. It's like, okay, so he was just being a creeper in that instance because he's evil. Fine. But then it's like, Julie was a super spy. Wait a second.
And it's confusing because I don't know if he was, he wasn't supposed to know that, because she makes mention of how she was just kind of using him. And yet there's a point when they're assaulting that temple where she literally runs up and just kills armed guards by finger poking them through the eye. Like, shink, 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 shink. And you're just like, does he just think that's normal?
Of course. All desperate underwear models can do that.
I was like, for so long,
it's why I needed to assert my control over her by having her pose topless. That way I could use her as the ultimate weapon.
For so many times, I was like, is she not supposed, because it takes a while before they reveal she's evil. And I was like, was she not super special and just killed armed guards by stabbing their eyes out unexpectedly? Or is they just waiting a long time for someone to actually be like, hey, Julie, it's kind of crazy what you did back there.
Hang on a second. I just realized, in the midst of all of this weirdness and people turning into zombies, us losing our friends who we've just made and having to, and dealing with tremendous stress from being in a no-win situation, Julie, how can you kill people by stabbing their eyes like that?
She's just like, oh, you know. She's like, you know, Julie, I kind of know something about you. You have a lot of, like, jumping around, super acrobatic, very Black Widow-ish style moves of taking people out. And Black Widow was a super spy. Are you a super spy? She's like, definitely not. Hip cock. And they're like, I guess that solves it.
Come on, would a super spy be able to do this?
But all that said, I still kind of like the series. It's goofy, dumb, fun, but it's something I think that you can have fun reading and kind of commenting on. Like, there's a lot of just silly moments where you're just like, characters are doing strange things, or the art's portrayed in a weird way. Like, a character hits somebody's hand with a baseball bat just to knock the phone out, but their hand didn't get hurt at all. You're just like, what an amazing fucking shot that must have been. And I think you have to, if you're a fan of the Resident Evil stuff, I think you should read it. It'd be fun at least to see Claire, who actually is a major character in this. It's not like she's a cameo who shows up at one point.
She just takes a while to get involved in stuff properly, because she's kind of off being somewhere safe for the first half of the series.
Yeah, but she has a very involved role in the second half, and I enjoy that. I like that. It's kind of cool seeing that mythos, like, combined into this. And I think this is the kind of tie-in story to, like, an existing franchise I like. Maybe not the Bikini Idol aspect of it per se, but this story that can exist as its own standalone sort of thing that can still show you a character you like kind of doing cool new things.
And, you know, also, I mean, it's there's not enough to it to really get bogged down. I realized very late, it's like, oh wait, shit, I had to read the manga recommendation for this week. I've been busy with a lot of stuff. And I was like, oh, I better just read as much of this as I can. And I got through a lot of it really quickly, because the chapters are short and very action oriented. There is a plot to it, but it's an incredibly basic plot. The characters are incredibly simple. So if you're just more a fan of the genre, and yeah, in particular a fan of Resident Evil, I can definitely see you having fun reading this. There's not really a whole lot to be bored by, honestly.
I'll also note, it's not, despite the fact that we keep, like, selling on it, it's not actually as, like, sexually exploitive of a series as I thought it would be.
It's an ecchi series. It's not, there's no nipples, for example.
Well, I wasn't even gonna, it doesn't even feel that cheesecakey to me at times. Like, they're in bikinis for a large part of it, but especially during a stretch in the middle, they really just don't focus on, like, a bunch of like gratuitous TNA shots or anything like that. Like it's heavy at the start and at the end it starts to come back, but there's a pretty long stretch in the middle where they just, you wouldn't even notice it except for the fact that there's a couple characters still in bikinis.
It would have been pretty hypocritical if the worst character in the series speech about us idols are only judged based on our boobs and butt, did not result in them being only good for their boobs and butt. So
yeah, just remember, if somebody starts turning into a zombie, you say, no, I don't want to kill my friends, and only good things will come of that.
Yes.
It's
yes.
Like the worst
lesson. As we have learned
from
every zombie series aside from this one. Well, this one and actually the previous one, come to think of it. That zombie that they refused to kill kept on coming back in good ways for them.
I'm here for you guys!
Is this the theme of this Halloween month?
That and spooky puns! Yeah,
well, I mean, that's every Halloween month. Alright, we are going to, yes, move on to the recap portion of Weekly Manga Recap. We're going to do things a little bit differently this week because we don't have a One Piece, and Chris has something that he wants to say at the end of all of this. So let's begin, as we normally do, with My Hero Academia number 156, The Power of Those Saved. So we get a bit of a flashback from where we ended the previous chapter with Ryukyu and her disciples crashing down through the ceiling, because we see at the beginning that they seem to take down Rikia, and they go over like, oh yeah, see, this guy is dangerous because he's like Parasite from DC. See, if he touches you, he can breathe in your vitality, and then he gets bigger and stronger. But we've tied him up, and he's not touching anyone, so let's go and help everyone inside. And Nejire starts leading people off. And what I noted about this is that the sound effect for them trotting off to go and help is go, go.
All right. Yeah.
It's actually a really humorous panel because Ryukyu is like, ah, what's that over there? And right before the guy starts to do horrible bad stuff. And, it turns out that the side effect of his taking the drug booster is that he doesn't need to touch people in order to breathe in their vitality. He could just do it normally. So he's, you know, breathing in the vitality of the guards surrounding them, as well as he also seems to get Suyu and Uraraka with it and starts smashing shit up again. So there's a little bit of fighting that goes on at the start of this. We get a proper explanation of Nejire's ability, which is wave motion, which is she can, shoot shockwaves from her body, but they tend to corkscrew, making them really slow.
I was like, I don't get it. I thought they explained it before and it was just some energy projection thing, which I guess it is, but this is one of those things I guess we need to see more of her for me to properly get, because unlike Morio's, like, phasing slash like pose based like eruption powers, or Sun Eater having the ability to turn into literally what he eats, this seems like weirdly simplistic and not very like deep, which I'm like, obviously that can't be the case if you made her part of the big three. Like, you put so much work into the other two, obviously that same work probably had to be gone into here. So I'm kind of waiting to, I guess, see more of it, but
in terms of putting her on the same level of those two guys. You don't expect her to take this very straightforward, ironically, path. I mean, it's, I assume that what they mean by the, her beams tend to corkscrew is that they go in a spiral pattern, which causes them to have to actually loop around and go slower. But
even then, though, it just seems like, is there something she uses that to her advantage on, or?
Yeah, you gotta wonder, like, how does that work with her? Cause otherwise she would just be, you know, an energy blaster with a weird quirk to her quirk.
Yeah.
They are called to by Deku, who shouts over to Uraraka and says, hey, we need backup, and the target is over there under that crossroads, directly underneath there. So Ryukyu makes a plan immediately upon hearing this, charges into Rukia, and they do a combination attack between her, Uravity, and Froppy, so that they essentially pick him up and then slam him down with help from Nijire's blasts. And that smashes him through the ground, and essentially going from there to where we left off at the last chapter. And of course, immediately after this, they see, like, wait a minute, Deku, you're down here, but who was that up there? And it's like, oh, of course it was Togen disguised, but I mean, that was pretty obvious.
Nick, what's the one girl's name though?
Toga.
No, not her. The big three girl.
Nejire?
What's the last name?
Isn't it Hado?
But Nick! Don't you mean Nejire Daido?
It doesn't even rhyme!
It does when you do the big cape thing.
But then the thing works when you do the cape thing.
It is 90% showmanship.
It doesn't even make sense. Oh, there's an explanation that follows from here that I don't really get. Oh, okay. I gotcha. So, essentially what they established in this quick little panel is that Twice summoned a copy of Mr. Compress, and I guess he compressed the ground so that they could tunnel their way out.
Yep.
Okay. That's
which is pretty crazy, like, that he actually has the ability. I guess we already knew this, but I guess I just haven't realized before. He has the ability to just copy other people and, mm-hmm. like, basically their quirks and everything, too. I'm like, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah. That's how they end up doing that, and also how they ended up, you know, because they actually dug a tunnel up through the ground so that all that Ryukyu and company had to do was smash the street, and then they fell through the hole and up to there. They quickly shout out orders to each other between, you know, Deku and everyone and all that stuff. Deku shouts out to Uraraka to get Nidai to safety. He runs to try and get Eri. Chisaki is still being all evil and destructive and stuff. And he does a cool thing where he snatches Eri and then uses powers to just kind of earthbend himself onto a pillar to start going up through the hole. It's like, oh, there's an escape route. I'm going up there. And Deku, of course, refuses to give up. He leaps after them. And in a very kind of... I'm just going to go through this without... I'll go through this in a little bit of detail, and then I think we'll talk about it, because it's a little bit, I don't know, stunted, I think. So, among all of the gravel that's, falling / flying through the air as they're rising up, one of the bits of rock has Lemillion's cape on it. Somehow it was thrown into the air and got caught on this rock. I don't know. Eri snatches it as they're passing by it. And we get this narration as she remembers Lemillion saying heroes' capes are there to wrap up little girls in pain. And she thinks, and so the narration explains that she didn't reach out for it consciously, but all the same. Then there's a flashback to Overhaul speaking with the boss, let's see, saying, hey, you remember her, right? Yeah, you had a falling out over her marriage and she left the family. That little one, Eri, is her daughter. The fool went and abandoned the girl, saying, my husband's dead, and this little pest is cursed. Apparently, one day, her husband touched the girl, and he just vanished. The power that manifests in her didn't resemble anything from either side of her family. It was a mutation, and not a curse. It's one of those rare things you hear about now and again. I'm not sure about the particulars or how she uses it. They say she ain't even aware of it, but she has the power to annihilate. It reminds me of you, Chisaki. While you're looking out for her, do a little research on her quirk. You're pretty good at that stuff. So they have similar quirks is the beginning explanation here. But in the course of his research, Chisaki discovered this is not restoring or healing that she's doing. It's something else entirely. It's a quirk that rewinds. And this is demonstrated as in the same moment that she snatches Lemillion's cape, Eri causes Nomeo to split off from Overhaul, and now they're two people again. Then we get more narration that says, the first time she attempted to run, she realized there was no getting away from him. She soon gave up. She spent her days as a captive getting carved up. That terrifying power she didn't even know how to wield, she blamed herself for being born with such a thing. All she could do was accept her cursed fate. But Lemillion's actions caused something in her broken spirit to stir. It pained her to see her would-be saviors getting hurt. But these people wouldn't give up even if it killed them, allowing a new feeling to bloom inside her. The feeling of needing to be saved awakens her. So, the first time I read through this, it seemed very rushed to me. I don't know how you felt about this, but it was kind of just like, and this is what's going on right now, so we just...
There's a bit of a rush to it. I think what hurts us more is there's not a lot of time for us to understand what Eri's power actually is, because we've known Eri's power to do one thing to this point, and that is take heroes' quirks away when her blood is put into a bullet, essentially. So how she actually herself does it, we don't know. It was almost the idea like, oh, she just like naturally has a way to take powers away from people with some manner of permanency, and maybe it exists in her blood, and that's like it's just a perpetual thing, and that's why it's there or something like that. It's not entirely clear. But this chapter, it's like, no, her power is to rewind. And rewinding also somehow erased her dad from existence. And also,
well, that makes sense.
And also allowed her to, cause the part that does make sense to me is like, oh, well, she reverses essentially Chisaki's combination. She unfuses him by rewinding him backwards. I'm like, okay, but how does that make it so her blood erases heroes' quirks? Because generally people
I
like...
I imagine that the explanation is going to be along the lines of it reverses the mutation.
It's just, it seems weird because it's essentially like saying like she, her blood unconsciously can just do that to a certain extent and not also erase them from existence. Like, it's one of those things where I'm like, I have to just kind of like wrap around the potential plot holes that might be here and just accept them, because it feels like I don't understand what her quirk does anymore. I can grasp the concept of it, but if I like had to write it out in actuality, I'd definitely come to a point where I'm like, she does this, and then in parentheses be like, somehow, like I'd have to just like relinquish the fact that I can't fully explain all this anymore.
I feel as though this might have been helped if there were no flashback to experimentation and conclusion of what her power does. And instead, we just got the whole, she had given up hope, but then when she saw the cape, all the same, those feelings were awakened inside of her. And then you see her do that to Chisaki and fall off of his shoulder. And that's it. You don't get like her quirk rewinds, because I think that having the explanation of the quirk and the explanation of what's going on in her head going on at the same time takes away from both, because there's a whole lot to process all at once together.
I love the stuff about her reaching out and grabbing the cape.
That's
and
great.
Jumping out. And I love that she broke Chisaki in this. Like, she slashed him in half and reverted him. I guess you could say you don't even need to have her, like, just say that she, like, something caused that. Have Chisaki be like, what did she do? Did she just do what I think she did? And leave it vague and then save next week maybe for that example. I feel like it really undercuts this huge moment of Eri choosing to save herself, basically, and being that inspired by Lemillion by having this entire long explanation in the middle of it. Because it really does distract you. It also distracts the fact that this chapter starts off by showing off what, like, the Ryukyu's team was doing. And it's like, is that going to have any relevance to this beyond it create a giant hole for Chisaki to escape out of? Like, that dude is still around. Like, I guess, was he just knocked out by getting smashed through the ground? Like, it seems like this is entirely irrelevant at this point. And we got this whole explanation for what fucking Nijire does and his quirk and how it advanced. It's just like, all this feels unnecessary. And just kind of detracts from what this chapter should have been. Eri, inspired by Lemillion and his cape, saves herself. And we call back to that whole what a hero's cape is for thing.
All right.
But Nick, don't yes, you Chris. Mean Midori blah? Like a vampire with blah.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
I'm going to just write that down as a prop because you laughed and that's good.
All right. We don't have Astra again this week, which is making me sad because it's, we're getting up close to like 3 weeks without this now. Instead, we're going to just head straight on to Food Wars Shokugeki no Soma. And, oh fuck, where am I? I should have actually scrolled to the chapter before.
It's page 84 if you need it.
I know, I'm getting there. Yes. All right. It's chapter 235, The Alchemist of Gourmet. Look at how happy Aizon looks with that, for them. It's just like, hey!
I made food! Fuck yourselves!
He should be extending that middle finger instead.
Oh, yeah. Ah!
So, last time, Aizon said that he was going to put all this asparagus in his food in order to neutralize the taste of Takumi's by making his pizza taste too sweet. Yes, Chris.
Don't you mean a scaricus? All right, we're good.
You can tell that one. That's fine.
Sweet. Yes.
Two props.
One prop. Two props.
So everyone in the cage is like, oh no, it's going to ruin Takumi's pizza.
Wait a minute, Nick. Everyone's saying it's not asparagus. It's artichokes. But sorry. Guys, don't you mean artichokes?
The fact that you had to make that recovery is pretty impressive. You can transfer that one. Yeah. You can transfer that one.
I gave a new one.
So, I like that Momo is making a note of the fact that, hey, you know, I know that you're trying to make sure that you ruin that guy's pizza and stuff, but if you mess up the taste of my dessert, you're going to be really sorry. I like that there's that emphasis on the fact that the Central is composed of talented individuals, whereas, you know, the first year trio that they've got going off, they're all about teamwork and compatibility and working together. And it seems like even with just that little hint, there's the possibility of, oh, well, maybe Central's going to screw themselves over by stepping on each other's toes.
Hmm.
So we have the judges start tasting Aizon's dish while everyone else is still cooking. He really cranked that one out quickly, didn't he?
He's like, artichokes require no work whatsoever. I just cooked them up. I cooked a bunch of that.
I did this in order to screw over Takumi, and also because I'm lazy.
He's like, I wanted to get back to playing my fucking Simpsons Tapped Out game. Just see him on the side like, ooh, Homer, you saucy little minx.
And yes, I will buy 10 trillion donuts. Thank you.
My donut empire. You know what? He does seem like the asshole who would play, like, Clash of Clans, and he has, like, a whole monopoly in that game that he uses to, like, make more money somehow. He's just like, I figured out, like, EVE Online. He's like, I actually make money playing EVE Online. Like, fuck this guy. Sorry, Nick.
Yeah, so the judges are impressed by this. We get the, flat top judge is like, so good! Okay. There's the whole thing where, oh yeah, Zazon is the alchemist. That's his whole deal. Soma has a taste of his dish as well. I guess he's just got time in between the super important cooking match to go over and be like, oh, nice. As he tastes it, yeah, oh, he has his clothes are melting off kind of thing. We get a pretty long explanation of the way that, the artichokes work in terms of how they enhance flavor. And basically what it means is that you've got the cynarine on your tongue. Eventually you chew it up and swallow it. And then all those blocked up taste buds are now super receptive to taste. And that's why it increases the sweetness, because they were blocked during the tasting of it before. Okay, fine. Also, Alice is explaining all of this, and then as she's finishing up her explanation, for some reason, she, like, has Kurokiba help her take her coat off? Okay. Yeah, she's hot in that.
Well, no, it's because she must have put on the lab coat.
Oh, she went to do the big explanation while wearing a lab coat, and then yeah. She's actually taking... Where did the lab coat come from, then?
It's just, you know, it's there. I love that little, like,
I have to look super official while I'm giving the super smart explanation. Okay,
now she's casual. Like, I'm a scientist now, but I don't want it on all the time. Kirk, even take my coat off.
He's like, yeah, I guess this is what I'm here for. Okay, then I'm somehow happier with that explanation than just like, Kirk, even randomly take my coat off. It's like, no, it's because she produced it, right? Ishiki is like, oh yes, this whole thing that Aizan did deserves compliments because of the experience that he has built up. I'm sure that skill, along with his egotistical determination to secure ever greater personal profit, that caught Azami Nakiri's attention. And we do get a cool little flashback from there of apparently what Aizan just does in his spare time, which is just pitting restaurants against each other in order to profit himself.
He's such a fuck. I love this dude because he's like, there's just one guy who's like, my entire company is ruined. And Aizan like walks up like, I'll help you out. And he's just like, thank you. And like, fucking his zombie has to come over and be like, why did you do that? And he's like, cause I get more money. Like, there's nothing I care about. I will rise as many fucking corpses from the ashes as long as it makes me money.
And there's also
he's the cooking equivalent of a war profiteer. Just understand that.
Pretty much, yeah, yeah. He gives an explanation of how he basically did the same thing for this restaurant that he's doing to Takumi, where he's like, oh yeah, that free samples that we gave out, they originated this one chemical which made them want to buy this stuff and didn't want to go to that one store. So, hey, you're in trouble. I'll help you out. And yeah, then someone who's there is just like, you just finished crushing them, and then you turn around and offer to help them with a smile on your face. Oh, you make it sound like that's a bad thing. I just acquired another wonderful business partner. What could be better than that? Dimples. So, yeah, and then there's the whole, it's like, oh, there's the reason you called the alchemist. And then we get the super fan service of this side of the match. I'm sure that there will be at least two, three. I'm going to put the over-under on three more.
Ooh.
No, over-under's on two. It's got to be on two.
Ooh, okay. So if there's more...
The over-under is on two. No, over-under is on 2.5, because I think that it's possible that there could be two. Over-under's on 2.5 if you guys want to make bets on how many more super fan service examples there will be in this round of the competition. There's five more, so that means that there have to be at least half as many also cause people to get, like, super orgasmic beyond this one. I would assume that Megumi's probably not going to get one, but I'm going to guess that it's definitely possible that there could be more.
I will take the over on that.
I'm going to take the over as well. I think it's going to be probably exactly three. Because I don't think that Megumi's going to get one. And that only leaves four more. But, we'll see. So, I did not know that this could be a fetish.
Everything's a fetish.
It never occurred to me in my wildest dreams that this particular act could get somebody going. But apparently, at least one person in the world thinks this is the highest thing ever. Of course, only Una experiences it because she's the only female judge of the three judges. And she says, so while she's thinking it, the incredible deliciousness is far too great, too amazing to be explained away as mere sleight of hand. No, this is a much larger performance, a bit of stage magic that bewitches all who witness it, an illusion I don't want to be freed from. And she imagines it as that magical act, that stage magic act, where, you know, you have the assistant hide in the box, and then the magician stabs the swords through it. And of course, there's more room inside the box than initially appears, so she is actually safe inside of it. Apparently, Une, in this particular magic act, is naked, and she's getting off from almost being stabbed and being crammed inside of this box. It's... whoa.
there are people in the chat posing that. That's my fetish gif, Fred, from Scooby-Doo's gif over and over again, I'm sure.
I mean, that's totally understandable, but just... wow. Guys, it's not that I underestimate Food Wars, it's just that I have no idea how we got there from this. It's like, I put artichokes in this! It's like I'm in a box with swords stabbing around me and I'm gonna come on them. How do you get from point A to point B?
Well, they do kind of paint Azon as being this magician, this alchemist, so I can get it from
connection.
That.
I do get that, but alchemy is not the same thing as stage magic, though.
Well, I guess what would be the other option? He's just like, it'd be like a shot of him, like, I don't know, like tearing off her arm or shoving her into a suit of armor. I don't really know what you do for that.
I don't know. Maybe he's turning her into the gold with the Midas touch and she's also naked.
That is true. You know what? Aizen has to win because they need to use that one in the future.
All right. So that's, Takumi's dish is apparently done baking in the oven, and Azon is mocking him. He's like, oh, what's with the long face? I know. Shouldn't we ask the judges to drink some water real quick? Wash some of that cinerine off their tongues? And all the people in the cage are like, yeah, do that! Make them chug a gallon! It's like, that's what the villain said. You're not supposed to agree with him.
He's mocking you.
He's mocking you. Oh, and, there's a weird note here that says, not necessary. The judges needn't do so if they don't wish to. Now, this is something that people were bringing up, being very upset about as we went over the whole signing explanation, which was like, judges are supposed to cleanse their palates in between dishes so that they can judge them fairly. It's like, yes, in reality, that is true. This is Food Wars. Let them have their shonen sports thing go on.
Let the villains cheat, essentially.
Let Azon put down his very specific counter-trap combo that should not work in the game, but it does in this case. Yeah.
Crush card!
Yeah. That one did not actually end up being nearly as good in later versions of the game. That seemed like the ultimate super card when it first came out, and then it's just like, well no, there's like a billion other ways you can summon powerful monsters that get around the crush card, so don't worry about it. Anyway. Takumi says, in response to this, they don't have to, I'm still going to win. And everyone's like, huh? And he's taking the pizza out, and they're like, what is that?
He's like, oops, I'm supposed to put it in for the 5 minutes, I put it in for the 50, it's very burnt now. Oh, the Mamma Mia!
With the increased sweetness, it actually tastes pretty good.
It's pretty good. I love the texture. I fucking love burned to shit food. It's so good.
Crunch.
The woman's like, I have a fetish for burnt food. Ah, and it's just her, like, naked, surrounded by the Wicker Man flames. Like, it's so good!
I love Nicolas Cage!
He's amazing! They put the bees on him!
Oh my god.
It's her with the bee mask on, naked, orgasm face. He's like, not the bees!
Oh. Alright. Where are we going? What are we doing next? It's, Dr. Stone?
Do we do Boruto next?
Oh, yes, you're right. We should do Boruto next. That was a thing this week. All right, we haven't visited this one since, well, last month. It's Boruto number 17, Ow, which references a very minor character from Naruto in a suddenly important role. But we'll get to that. We see Phantom of the Opera guy from Evil Villain Group on the color page. He's like, look at how awesome my mask is. And I'm like, nah.
Sweet beard, though. My mask is pretty cool.
So the primary thing going on, I have to note one thing that, cause we saw Konohamaru, like, investigate, like, that crashed blimp in the previous chapter to recover something. Apparently a guy that he was with, is dead now, or is very close to dead. I don't know who attacked him, because the guy was apparently just like, hah! You can leave now, instead of recovering the thing in the crash.
Bye.
Fuck you, glasses guy. I like that Konohamaru's way of getting the data is to use this scroll flash drive.
My Ninja Scroll USB stick. Click. So I'm cool. Like, why wouldn't you just think, it's not as though the magic scroll produces a USB. It's like you just made a USB in the shape of one. Why wouldn't you make it smaller? He's like, oh. Did you ask Batman why he doesn't shape his batarangs more conveniently? They're shaped like bats for a branding reason, fucko. These are Ninja Scroll USBs. These sell like hotcakes.
So we get Team Boruto in for a meeting with Sasuke and Shikamaru and Naruto.
But Nick!
Don't I mean...
Don't we mean Konohamabu?
No. No. No.
Fuck you. All right. They can't, they can all be winners. All right.
You've been pretty good this episode. So no, you were due for a bad one. Anyway. So I guess that since nepotism, Boruto just gets called into meetings with the Hokage a whole bunch for minor missions. Okay. So in order to escort this artificial hand that Naruto was testing out in that sparring match he had with Boruto, they're just sending Boruto and company on this. It's like, I don't know, this experimental ninja tech. Don't you want to, you know, put more experience? No? Just level C mission? Okay. All right.
Maybe also, there's grand wisdom behind it. They're not explaining to us yet. It's not like...
They're not even going with Konohamaru, who is their team leader, nor are they substituting someone to go with them.
Yet Konohamaru really feels shoved in as their, like, leader, because he is not fulfilling that Kakashi role at all. Like, he is not around. He's not leading them. He's in a completely separate fucking scene right now. And I can understand the notion of, like, maybe we're trying to lure out this evil group's members by sending Naruto out there, and maybe there's like secretly good ninjas following them. But this, to me, this doesn't feel at all like that Zabuza sort of scene where they were like, we sent you off on this mission. We had no idea though about like the Zabuza involvement in it, and we did not realize it was going to be a much higher ranked mission than we thought it was. Like, this isn't just something we mistakenly put you on.
They were just escorting some guy.
Yeah.
That was it.
This one, it's like, deliberately, here's a very precious artifact of very dangerous power that we're going to, like, lock in a briefcase and hand to the three of you kids. You fucking 10-year-olds at this point. You're not even chunin yet. You're fucking genin still. So, good luck. It's like, I don't think you should do this.
Also, there's a whole thing about the Otsutsuki are just the thing in the
world. But Nick!
Yes, Chris?
Don't you mean Gotsutsuki? So spooky!
Ghosts are spooky. Alright, so... I get very big fanfic vibes off of this whole thing, because they're like, there are more of the Otsutsuki out there that are a danger to the village. And it's like, wasn't that just the thing that was just introduced at the very, very end of the previous series? Yes, they're the villain organization now. Just descendants from this moon tribe thing. I don't know. They seem to be, like, getting mined for a lot of after the end stuff for Naruto, it seems like. It's like, this the one idea that wasn't completely closed from Akatsuki because we decided Orochimaru's a good guy. Anyway, they're like, oh, they're the danger or whatever. Katasuke, the scientist guy who gave Boruto the ninja jutsu replicating thing, he is going with them on this mission to escort the artificial hand thing. Boruto is upset about because he's like, I'm super against using ninja tech weapons now. And Naruto's like, you know, the only reason that we banned that and why you were disqualified from that exam is because it was meant to specifically test your skills as a ninja without using them. We're still going to use every tool that we have in our availability. I hate them! Okay. So, that's their mission. They're going on a train to take Katasuke and the artificial hand to somewhere else. Somewhere else. And Boruto bitches around about it, moping for a while before agreeing to go. And we get such wonderful lines from Sarada as, yeesh, he's such a dork.
I'm so glad that this is a monthly series, because if this were weekly, the chapter would have ended on Naruto being like, no, I don't want to go! And then there'd been another fucking chapter of him having to be convinced to go before they would have actually finally gotten to the point of this fucking chapter, which happens all on that train. Yeah, like, there is so much superfluous nonsense during this shit where they have to, like, convince Naruto to go. And look, there's a complicated issue here, because you could actually say that this argument goes further than the scientific ninja tool. You could almost argue this is like a discussion about guns, because it's very much of a thing of like, do guns have a purpose in this world? And it's a complicated issue of like, should this weapon that's very powerful be used by everyone else? But the base argument is Boruto being like, I don't like this thing. I used it and it got me in trouble. And thus, it's always evil. And his dad has to be like, well, no, like, the way you used it was cheating. You used it to get an advantage on it, but there's good reasons for it. No, there's not!
I'm 12 and super wise!
You're like, why is there so much emotion to this complication here? You just, oh wow, it turns out you can use a knife not for stabbing people, but for cutting food. Like, who would have thought of this? Like, I don't know. It just seems strange here.
The three kids go back to Deus Ex Boruto Revolution. We get a little, you know, Boruto's having a pity party and Sarada and Mitsugi are there. And Sarada's like, hey, we should go on this mission. And it's, you know, an assignment we were given directly from the Hokage. So I'm going to take it. And Boruto's like, fine, you can go. And you go to Mitsugi after she leaves. And Mitsugi's like, actually, I'm, you know, only going to go if you go. And so if that happens, then Sarai's going to be all on her own. Which is, you know, just going to the things like, hey, you're not going to let your friend just go on this mission that could get her in trouble without you being there to help her, right? Which he follows up on with some other cool stuff. First off, I like the idea that he's going through, at least with that whole he will be the moon to Boruto's son thing. He's like, I'm going to shadow you. I'm going to go where you go. And also he brings up, hey, you know, you promised that you were going to be Sarada's right-hand man when she becomes the Hokage. But you're just gonna go and let her go on this mission by herself? What the hell is up with that?
I love that
promise you made for yourself.
I love that logic on how to get him to want to go on the mission. That's very cool.
And, he also points out, hey, you know, by the way, that artificial hand, that's also the Hokage's hand. It's not just a tool. It's a hand that is crucial in defending our fellow villagers, including your little sister and your mother. It's like, basically just like hitting all the buttons. It's like, Sarada's your friend. You're going to protect her. Your family could be in danger if you don't do this. Like, fine, I'll go. I like it though.
Rump. Also, while he's doing it, he's doing creepy snake things, like wrapping his hand around it. It's like, come on, man.
You should go and protect your friends.
Like, stop it. Ow. So, stop it.
I'll go. Fine. Let me get that face.
Holy shit.
So, Boruto agrees to go, and they're like, oh, there's no sitting room on this train. Where are we supposed to sit? And Sarada's like, if you hadn't been such a bitch, we could have gotten assigned reserved seats. But because we decided to only go at the last minute, we don't have that. Fuck you. Also, Boruto acts like a total idiot when he's like, oh, sweet, there's seats over there. Just, like, starts running towards them. And Sarada's like, don't run on the train, stupid. Boruto's such a fucking 8-year-old, God.
It's that moment where you're just like, I feel bad for Sarada because she's had to mature so much so quickly because this kid is not getting any smarter, it feels like.
Oh my god, the whole freaking maturity arc. Like, Mitsuki, we just had that one side story where he had his coming of age all at once, and it was weird and awkward and rushed. But Sarada had such an awesome beginning to end story of coming to terms with her family and who she was and what she was going to be as a ninja and what her existence meant. And even when she was at her most vulnerable and least mature and most of an asshole to her family, she was still so much more sympathetic than this blonde asshole.
Boruto got better, but every so often
he's really taken a step back very suddenly, hasn't he?
Steps back. It's really that fucking bitch fit he threw and, like, ran away to the ramen shop is just what baffles me. I'm like, this is so like, I get we got a great moment out of Mitsuki out of it, but it really comes at the cost. It was burying you as a cost of it, basically.
Oh, man. I like how his response to not getting his way is essentially to go and cry in his milkshake, but the milkshake is, you know, ramen. Takasuke recognizes that the guy sitting in the booth there is Remus Lupin of the new Defense Against the Dark Arts professor. Sorry, ow, that one bodyguard for the Mizukage in early Naruto. He's the guy who, like, you know, had the stolen Byakugan in his eye that apparently has been ripped out now, I'm guessing. It looks like it. I would not blame you at all if you don't remember who this guy is in the slightest. So he was the guy who wasn't the weird glasses-wearing shark teeth kid.
I'm starting to remember that now.
So apparently most of his action days are behind him because of his injuries. He has an artificial arm now. They have a conversation that essentially boils down to, I hate artificial ninja weapons and tech and da-da-da. Well, if it weren't for them, I would have probably died.
See, that's the thing. Like, Boruto's argument would make sense if you did just look at it purely as an argument about, like, guns or weaponry or things like that. It's him, like, saying, like, I don't like these things. They're dangerous and are used to hurt people. And it's like, okay, you can make an argument out of that. But instead, it's sort of like an all-purpose, like, I hate technology! You're like, but technology can be used to make people's lives much better. No! No!
Sarada's dig at him, which is, you know, technology also is, you know, what powers your precious computers and video games. So I guess you only care about the essential stuff in life.
Yeah, well, his argument's like, this is totally different.
Burn.
Scientific ninja tools aren't necessary. It's like, so you like, it's kind of a joke, I guess. It's like saying, like, oh, but he's saying video games and television are necessary or something like that. But it's still just like, what is this argument that he's coming from? It seems to be entirely based on the fact that you used the scientific ninja tool to cheat, got caught, and got your fucking, like, you know, punishment thrown down publicly about it. Like, it really just seems to be like a petulant, bitchy child, like, tantrum.
It's one of those things where, like, you know, you have the drug special where a person comes to light after taking a look at themselves, realizing that their health is bad and that they've pushed everyone else away because of their drug abuse and they've ruined people's lives because they've, you know, been this tremendous burden on them. But instead of coming to terms after all of that, they come to light after they've been caught in the bathroom at school smoking and got detention. We're like, drugs are bad because I got thrown into detention after smoking them. It's like, you shouldn't smoke, that's true, but...
And it's an even weirder argument, though, because it's not even something that's objectively kind of like what you can see the argument for drugs. He just seems to be arguing about all technology at this point. Because
even, like, the tool that he specifically used, imagine, like, the benefits that could come from that are non-combat related. Because there's healing jutsu, too. What if you use it to store healing jutsu? It would revolutionize the way that medical technology worked, because in any given emergency situation, people could be carrying around this handy device on their wrist that you could then pull and heal someone from a grievous injury. No one would die from accidents basically ever as a result of that. And he's just like, no, I got caught once and everything is bad. So eventually he sees like, oh, this guy would have died and would not be able to live his life as fully as he can without ninja technology. So I guess that they're kind of okay, maybe sort of. And there is a weird bit though in between where Al goes, you know, thanks to Dr. Katasuke and scientific ninja tools, I'm now alive, which is, you know, mostly a miracle. So, hey, kid, you don't care for scientific ninja tools, do you? And Bord's like, guess not. Well, what if I hold this kunai out of your throat? Convincing argument.
He's like, shit, you got me.
And he just says, look, you know, you'd be dead if you'd been my enemy just now. But he's holding a screwdriver, and he says, see, this isn't inherently good or evil. It all depends on how you use it, no matter what it is. That's my opinion. Also, box cutters, 9/11.
So, can I just note, like, he lunged at Naruto with a weapon drawn to kill him, and the sole reaction that Sarada and Mitsuki has is like, shit. Like, you'd think that these two who are supposed to be, like, super talented ninja would have, like, had some, like, they'd been at least preparing, like, something or, like, to move. They're both just sitting there still completely like, holy shit, he almost killed him.
They're just kind of, yeah, shocked into an action. It's not that they were too slow to stop him. It's the fact that they're just kind of like,
oh, fuck. Naruto almost got shanked.
So Boruto, they go their separate ways immediately after that.
Having fully earned one another's friendship, by the way.
I guess.
like Naruto or Boruto is truly like, thanks, mister.
You see the error of my ways by holding a sharp object to my jugular vein.
Thanks for threatening my life and teaching me about the importance of technology. Bye.
And apparently after
I'm going to go complain about Dog and Rope on the internet now. Like, it's just, he's just a bitchy child every other moment of the day.
Apparently after that, we see that there was just a mysterious, ominous, cloaked figure sitting immediately behind Ao the whole time, I guess.
Everyone's like, hey, Mitsuki, do you see, like, the dude in, like, an obviously evil black cloak, like, right behind us? Like, right behind, like, I could see the top of his head the entire time. You think there's anything weird about that? No. All right. Oh shit, that dude almost killed Boruto. Like, he's the worst ninja right now.
I understand that the implication is that he only appeared, like, directly after all of the rest of them had gotten off of the train. But you have to wonder, though, why Al was just sitting there for a bit. Is he going to a different place? Is his stop later on? I guess, maybe? Is that ever established at any point? I don't know. I like to imagine, though, that this guy, instead of, like, just appearing all ninja-like, you don't even see how he got there. He was just kind of curled up in the fetal position on the bench to hide.
Or, like, he was sitting next to, like, a really annoying girl beforehand. She was just, like, talking on her cell phone and typing on her laptop at the same time. And he's just like, could you keep it down? Fine.
I'm trying to read.
Do they have a food cart on here? There's always someone in the bathroom. Oh, my belly doesn't feel good. Oh, they're off. Hey, what's up, Al? You're pretty cool, right? Yeah, it's just me, Cloak Dude. My super cool mask and my shitty neck beard. What's going on?
So Al uses a lot of code words that are in bold and italics to let you know that they're super important, but you're not supposed to understand what they actually are. He also uses the term grass, which I hope to God is the equivalent to root, and that all of them are just really shitty plant terms for their secret agencies. He uses also terms like inner and outer and stuff. And also, I have a crate here on the floor. Necessary intel and weapons. Feel free to use them. The mission elders clean up. Also, the likes of you may not require either. And I was like, oh, I'm getting too old for this. My first actual combat in 16 years. And I believe the implication is supposed to be that he is supposed to retrieve the ninja tech thing, because the final page is a split panel between him and Boruto being like, he was such a good guy. I want to see him again soon to ask him all sorts of stuff.
I can't wait till we have a like amicable conversation again. Well, this is what we're going to do because we're friends now.
Presumably. So that was a chapter.
It was decent for a portion, but it was not, in the grand scheme of things, a very strong chapter. I like what we're headed towards. I like bringing back like a minor character from Naruto and making him more relevant, but.
But what a minor character.
Well, it's more significant than that fucking cat lady, I guess, who married Akamaru. Or not Akamaru.
No, she married Kiba. It would have been a very different series if she married Akamaru, Chris. Do you take this woman to be your lawfully wedded wife?
Oh!
Oh, yes, I do.
Kiba's just like, what the fuck? I completely misread this woman's intentions while we were having those dates. What? Yeah, Akamaru's coming. It's a weird question to ask, but of course, he's my faithful partner, so he'll come along with me on all our dates. You seem really happy to hear that. Okay, see you soon.
I don't know if the restaurant serves dog treats. I guess we'll have to see. Do you think Akamaru will actually sit and eat with us? You insist he does. Okay.
What's that? You want me to be at the end of the table? Well, okay.
You keep asking me to go up and get drinks, but we have a waiter. Like, he's supposed to come by and give us those. All right, I guess I'll get up and get them for you.
Every time I get back, you're, like, smoothing down your hair. Like, what's that about? Okay. So, Dr. Stone next.
But, Nick!
But, Chris.
Don't you mean Dr. Frankenstone? Blah!
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I get that.
Yes! 5 points! 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 points!
I believe that we have established that we are counting these differently, so, but whatever. I'm not telling.
79 points! That's a new record!
Z equals 31 friends have each other's backs. With an interesting cover page of Kohaku and Chrome and Senku all posing around a giant-ass tree. I do like that it's kind of meant to be this whole, like, oh, it's, you know, Chrome and Senku back-to-back, but also there's just Kohaku up there just chilling out in the branches. It's like, I climbed up here. I'm action girl. Anyway, at the end of the last chapter, Senku said to Chrome that he's going to teach him everything that he knows about science in the case that he dies when they go to retrieve the sulfuric acid, because he doesn't want both scientists in the world to die. And should that happen, all of science would be lost to humanity. Chrome gets very shonen about this. He gets this determined look in his eyes. And he's like, fuck that! No, going anyway. Also, there is more manly friendship teasing that happens prior to this, where, you know, Chrome's like, oh, no, you can't just, you know, designate your successor. That's bad luck. He's like, oh, you're such a sweetheart. Okay. The true romance of this series, despite all the implications of who is going to marry Ruri. Could it be Chrome? Could it be Senku? Nah. They're saving themselves for each other, clearly.
Obviously. Also,
and I can't get the page to load that I'm trying to get to. Literally, I go past it and that page loads, but no, I can't get this one. Fine.
I had that issue with a page of The Promised Neverland this week. Let's all send emails to Jeff and yell at him.
Why isn't it working? So Chrome makes quite the face. Which means I'm not inheriting anything like this, because essentially what your plan is it's okay if my friend dies, and then that means if that's the case, then I'm not going to help you out with this. I'm not going to go along with this, because then that means that you're going to just sacrifice yourself, essentially. So, you know, too bad. This means that you have to come back, because if you die here, then science does stop. So you have to come back alive. 10 billion%. You, Senku! And we get a flashback from Kohaku's perspective, because during this whole conversation, I'm not sure if it was actually, if we actually made sure to know it last time, but Kohaku's listening in. She's constantly listening in on everything, apparently, that these two get up to. And this is actually a very, surprisingly, a Kohaku chapter, actually. All the stuff with this, how are we going to go about getting the ass mask and stuff, is really just a backdrop to get some very important information about her. Because the chief, her father, says, hey, your mother's dead, and there's the shamaness, you know, and this is the duty of the shamaness. They have the 100 tales, 100 stories filled with all manner of knowledge. Without fail, they've been passed down through generations in this village. And apparently those stories include Pokemon and Hokuto no Ken.
I hope this is a fucking, like, a foreshadowing to the fact that the 100 tales are all just fucking manga from out time. I will lose my shit in excitement if that's what it turns out to be, because that is such a dope idea for a shonen manga series that, like, in the future, the greatest knowledge we have is from these books. So let me tell you the tale of One Piece. It doesn't end for some reason. It just stops abruptly. But let me tell you the tale of the boys from Bakuman. They're just like, sir, what's the manga?
These guys are kind of sexist, aren't they? Shut up!
Shut up and go back and train for that tournament where if you win, you get to marry my daughter.
Unfortunately, one of the surviving stories was a robot. I will say I don't recognize what series is supposed to be the girl with bunny ears and sword riding a pterodactyl.
Clearly it's Battle Bunny Ribbon from League of Legends, Nick. Riding the turtle from Finding
Only
Nemo.
Only she survived. Actually, that's the twist. The 100 tales are just the backstories of 100 different League of Legends champions.
Or they're just bad fan fictions. That's what survived. He's like, now let us tell you the tale of a world trigger to my heart and backdoor part 4.5 hashtag the awakening. She's like, sir, this seems so inappropriate.
Recap. Oh man. So yeah, the chieftain's like, do you understand, Kuhaku? Ruri's body will not last much longer, and we cannot allow the 100 tails to be lost. You are in good health, so you will inherit the role of shamaness from Ruri. And Kuhaku immediately said, I'm not inheriting anything, because that's not if that's the case, because that means it's okay if my sister dies. That's the plan then, so I'm not going to go along with it. And she, you know, ran away from there. And essentially, Kohaku's logic is, if I ever become qualified to be shamaness, then my sister, Sombra as she is, won't have that reason to live for. So even if father hates me, it's for the best. I'll be the wild, untamable daughter, the furthest thing from a good candidate for a shamaness. I'll carry this hot spring water to her 1,000 times, 10,000 times, whatever it takes, I'll heal my big sister, Ruri. And this paints her in an entirely different light than we understood her before. It was always just that she was this wild, untamable child that completely didn't fit in with the village and, you know, eventually took things one step too far and got expelled after bringing Senku home, basically. And now we see that that's because she just loves her sister and needed to do this or felt that she did. And it's cool that we see this because it makes perfect sense why she thinks of it in this case. It's because that's the exact same thing that Chroma's doing. And it shows a number of different things. It shows Kuhaku's resolve. It shows this sense of camaraderie that she feels and she senses between Senku and Chrome. And she perfectly understands the bond between them as a result of having this prior experience. It's really, really good.
Yes, it is a very well done scene. The symmetry between the two scenes was a little heavy-handed, but I still really enjoy the way they basically framed this chapter as one thing, and then we're like, oh, wait, no, it's about... Less, it's
maybe have one less completely identical parallel in the conversation come up.
But I do love just how it all came together and yeah, framed this chapter as, like, it's Senku versus Chrome. But then, like, yeah, it's also going to be actually all about Kohaku for a large portion.
So Chrome proposes an alternate solution because he's saying, like, look, you're telling me to stay at home just to stay safe, but clearly you're just trying to protect me. Well, no, I'm not your kid, jerk. And Senku says, no, my reasoning is completely rational because we've got the gas masks and stuff, but we only have them working theoretically. We have no way of testing them. And hey, you know, I know everything better than anyone else here about the gas masks. So our odds are best if I am the only one going, and that is it. And Chrome says, no, that's bullshit. We should have two scientists on the scene acting as a tag team. Oh, are they going to go for the titles, Chris?
They need a good tag team name. What would it be?
Science rules now.
Like the Bill Nye, that's like they hit the Bill Nye clip at the start.
Bill Nye's their manager. He's like,
science.
I don't really know anything about wrestling, but let me tell you guys something that's really cool.
Every fucking tag match they have gets into a Bill chant. Bill, 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 Bill.
They completely forget about the tag team. Bill Nye goes on to have the best career out of all of them.
He's world champion by the end of it.
Crow is just like, why did you choose this guy as our manager? And Seku's like, he's my hero.
He made science fun.
I thought he just liked science in general.
Yeah, but he made science fun. That's hard. There's so many numbers.
So yeah, Chrome proposes the alternate strategy of, hey, we'll have the two most knowledgeable of us go together. That way, if one of us gets in trouble, the other one can try and rescue them. And Seku's like, well, yeah, but then the worst case is the gas will kill us both. And he says, though, in reality, this is not going to increase our chances very much, though, if we do this. It would be like a microscopic amount. But Chrome just counters by saying, hey, Taiju and Yuzuriha, you know, those two, right? They snuck into the Tsukasa Empire spies. And I'm pretty sure they're risking their lives by doing that. But you trust them and they trust you back. And it's the same with us. As long as we're actually friends with neither looking down the other, I'm just protecting you. Get out of here with that crap and tell me what I really want to hear. And Senku's like, all right, fine. Let's make another freaking gas mask, Chrome. You're putting your life in my hands. And then we get one final big badass shot of the two of them together. I'm not sure if they're facing each other or if they actually did get up next to each other and go, And then Kohaku's like, I'm up here still, so good. Anyway, she says, hey, Chrome, you know, you remind me of myself, because if Big Sister Ruri were to marry a man like you, I'm sure everyone would be thrilled, but the heavens didn't bless you with fighting ability. I guess the gods just aren't that accommodating. And then she just kind of resubmits, hey, you know, my sister is going to either wed Kinro or Ginro, so, hey, by way of apology, how would you like me as a bride? My sister and I look alike, after all. And I freaking love
this best.
These two panels. It's amazing. It's this one shot. Basically, it's find the difference in the game. They're two identical pictures for one. When after he says, you look alike, Ruri's a maiden and you're a gorilla. And he's even without changing his pose or facial expression, giant lumps on his head. Like I said, a gorilla.
And Ruri's Kohaku's just up in the tree, smiling the whole time.
It's amazing.
It is a great fucking, like, comedic switch.
And I love the follow-up to that, too, where Kohaku's like, hey, what's the big idea, Kohaku? You fall in love with me? And Kohaku's like, no, I didn't even love. No. Yeah, I didn't think so. All right. I do love the freaking camaraderie displayed between, first Chrome and Senku and then Kohaku and Chrome, though. That's just shows that they are more of that kind of like, why do you guys treat each other like that? Well, you treat your friend like that too, so.
Yeah.
And, we get a brief montage of the construction of another gas mask. And, it's a very cool looking rickety frickin' thing that they've got going on with this giant glass beaker that's slung over their backs. So yeah, they've got the gas masks and they're gonna go and get that sulfuric acid. So there you go.
Da dun dun da dun.
So cool chapter, I must say.
It was a very cool chapter. A lot of really cool stuff happens, a lot of great conversations, good stuff.
All right. So we are going to hold off on We Never Learn until the end. And instead, for right now, we're going to talk about The Promised Neverland. So, last time, the nameless guy led Ray and Emma into the armory where there were guns. and now we pick up with chapter 59, Choose Your Weapon! So, yeah, there's an armory here, and Ray and Emma are both like, What the fuck? Guns.
Holy shit.
Yeah, the guy says like, yeah, we just kind of happened to come across this, you know, piano unlocking thing by chance. When we arrived here, it was slightly out of tune. I wouldn't notice that though. So basically the room wasn't meant to be found easily. He does not mention who actually found the armory. So yeah, the guy says to Random, choose your weapons. I don't care what Minerva intended or what this armory means or who the weapons are for. We're going to go into enemy territory. So we're going to where they live and we need to be prepared for them. Even if you have weapons, you'll die when you die. But we can put up a fight if we're armed. So, and I'm not going to save you guys. Not. I hate you.
Hey, all of you, you're all dumb.
And, he hands a rifle or I guess a submachine gun, I'm not sure. I don't know what these things look like, to Emma. And she's like, guns are heavy. Yes, they are. So Ray's like, so what do you want to do? And Emma's like, I don't want anything heavy. And Ray's like, all right, I'm going to run with a knife because knives make you run faster.
He's like, I bet if you hold your arms out behind you, you run even super faster.
Naruto run.
But I don't like Naruto. Naruto is old trite. I made my new original character called Ryoto, and he's the best ninja of all the lands. He belongs to all of the villages, and he has the fucking Sharingan and the Byakugan and the Raijingan because he has all the eyes. Because he has his baby memories.
Eyes. He's got a third eye. I'm a K-pop.
Yeah, don't you remember from his baby memories? He kept those because all the best guys have baby memories.
No way. She's like, Ray has a stupid name. I'm gonna be Naruto.
Oh, so much better. I'm so smart.
You know, scribbling over the cover of the manga that he's made himself.
He's just high-fiving himself for 20 minutes. It's just the dude like, I'm not gonna let that kid have a knife. You don't get weapons.
Not because I'm worried he'll do to himself, but because what he might do to me.
He's gonna be running with his fucking arms behind him holding knives between his fingers.
He's
like Wolverine.
He's going to trip and hit us so many times.
He's like, it's not Wolverine, it's Ray Wolverine. Alright? Hashtag original character. Do not steal.
Oh, I'm gonna put this up on my demon art now.
Right next to hashtag Sonic the Rage Hog.
So, like, he's really angry. No, he's got Ray in his name instead of head.
Stupid. It's like you haven't even played the games.
All right. So, Ray says, yeah, I do agree that we want to, like, not weigh ourselves down with too many weapons. And extra weapons are unnecessary. But if we're discovered and we don't have a chance to run, what do? And he does actually recall when he was cornered by all of the hounds prior to where Sonju saved him. So, okay, valuable learning experience there. Emma looks over at the nameless guy and is like, I'm not going to tell you what I'm taking. Just watch. And he grabs one of the rifles and he takes a whole bunch of extra clips. And that's it. And he's got a knife. He doesn't actually take a whole lot with him, which does seem to be following the whole, we shouldn't travel too heavy. So even though this guy is much bigger and stronger than they are, he is also traveling light. And anyway, you can only carry one gun and one sidearm and one grenade at a time, so it makes sense.
And part of it is just picking up ammo from other people, too.
Yeah. You gotta make sure you use those ammo caches, yeah. So Emma's like, I'm gonna take a knife! And there's a very sudden little comic relief moment where she's like, I thought about taking this one, but I don't think I'd be able to use it. And it's just like next to a freaking rocket launcher. Rocket launchers are the theme of this month more than freaking any horror element is.
But Nick!
Yes, Chris.
Don't you mean a bazooka? Hashtag points.
So, yeah, and there's even like a little imagined bubble of her firing the rocket launcher looking like the happiest person in the world as she does it. Okay. Then, they're like, okay, let's think about this. And, you know, cause Emma says like, I've got the bow and arrows and I've only just gotten used to using them. I have experience using them. Also, they're light. And if we take a knife, I can make new arrows with them and there'll actually be, you know, more that we can use that for. But Ray's like, okay, I should actually take a weapon and one that's easy to use. And then we won't have too much to carry even with the ammo. And so he picks up basically a derringer. This like four barreled derringer. And Emma's like, what the hell is this? And Ray says, look carefully at that. And she's like, a thing that's important that I am tactfully covering up with my hand when I reach for it and the panel is introduced.
It looks like either a steam gauge or maybe a compass.
If it's a compass, it would make a lot of sense. But
like,
I
can't think of what a pressure gauge would do on a like a pistol of that size, unless it's like a fucking steampunk gun and it's got like chambers in there. So I have to assume it's for the compass aspect.
I don't know anything about guns, so. And then after a bit, Ray just says, "We'll come back alive for sure, okay? For sure."
For sure, yo. Now let's go. We're out of 5,000.
All right. And, so after they, gotten their gear, Emma goes to talk with Don Gilder and is like, be careful when you hunt together and the garden. Ray gets the bandage taken off of his ear. They're like, oh yeah, that was a thing that was going on. I'm assuming that Emma's not gonna be able to do it quite so easily, considering that they, you know, removed Ray's tracking device, whereas Emma cut off most of her ear. So, yeah.
They're gonna give her a robot ear at some point. And Ray gets furious. Why don't I get a robot ear?
My ear.
I'm gonna cut my ear off now, just like fucking Van Gogh.
I want a robot ear, Ray!
She's like, Ray, he didn't do it because he was artistic, he did it because he had Alzheimer's! Fuck you! I don't like your revisionist history!
I'm gonna have Alzheimer's!
He's like, I brand everything! Hashtag ow!
Alright. There's a brief little moment between Ray and some of the younger kids, because they're like, we would go with you if we could. And especially Don Gilda, because they're worried that they can't go. But your decision is correct, and in order for everyone to survive, this is the best way. And then there's a full-page panel of Ray and Emma in their overcoats. They're like, okay. Also, they have boots.
They got cool-looking boots. Can't lie.
That's a nice boots. All the kids jump on Emma and are like, nah, we have to say goodbye again. And Nameless Guy is like, I hate children. And then Gilda goes to the Nameless Guy and says, bring them home safely. Because if you don't, there's going to be trouble here. I need at least one of them to definitely come back alive here. If something happens and you decide to come back halfway through, one of them better make it back here safely. The guy's like, what, you asking me for a favor? She says, no, I'm stating my intention. Because if they don't both come back alive, I'm going to blow up this shelter.
It's interesting. I wonder if that notion of at least one of them needs to come back alive is something that's meant to come into this. That if some way Ray or Emma don't return from this mission for whatever reason. You know, I'd have to assume that if it was somebody at this point, I feel like Emma can't, but they already tried having Ray do that like big sacrificial moment earlier. So I don't know, but
I imagine it's something that's probably going to come in as a tease. Like that maybe one of them will die and the other will be safe. But there's no certainty.
But then way. Norman will save them.
Hey, possibly. Or maybe the Nameless Guy is Norman from an alternate dimension.
Holy shit.
It's a pretty effective way of ensuring that the guy will at least pull them out of lethal, mortal danger, considering that she's like, if you don't bring them back, we're going to blow up your frickin' home that's your in their safe shelter. So there you go. And that's basically it. She hugs Ray and Emma at the end of that, and she says, promise you'll come back safely, and that's it.
Indeed. Good chapter.
And a nice little bit of character development for Gilda, who was always, you know, more just the worrisome member of their group, and gotten many chances to contribute stuff as a result of that. And I imagine that we're probably going to come back and see more of her later. So it's important to get that done.
All right.
Oh, we didn't read Lycopene, by the way.
No. All right, so
that's your Lycopene recap, everybody.
We have three chapters of the Seven Deadly Sins to get through because they're all pretty. But me,
don't you mean
the seven deadly sins? It doesn't work. This series is already too spookily titled. It doesn't work. I can't even do anything with the title. The pacifier demon's already pretty spooky as it is, because it includes demon and pacifier, which relates to children who are terrifying to the first planet. So we're just gonna have to recap it normally, I guess. Alright, so remember, Chandler, the evilest demon of them all, has gone after fucking Melodious.
I can't believe his name's Chandler.
The pacifier demon, Chandler.
Could I be any more horrifying?
He's like, are you guys done not dying yet? Thanks. And essentially he goes after Elizabeth, and I'm going to have to abridge a lot of this because again, there's three chapters. We don't have time for this. He just counters immediately Merlin's box because he taught Melodious full counter, so he knows it. He does that. Merlin tries to fight back, and he absolute cancels her, basically, and cancels the magic seal that reveals herself to what she truly is, and she's a young girl. Like, I guess, it's tough to tell. She looks like she'd be 4 size-wise, but this is a manga, so maybe she's meant to be like 8. But essentially the idea that, like, her original form is like 8 years old, maybe. I don't know if we've had the full context for why Merlin's backstory is still kind of a secret, but Merlin's stuck as a child's body, but before he could just like snap this young girl in half, basically, Diane reaches in.
Well, he also says that she is someone's daughter.
So. Yeah. Braylon's, I guess. That might be like a Merlin thing. I don't know that much about Arthurian legend, so that may be a connection I'm not getting. But Diane runs in, or reaches in, grabs Elizabeth and Melodious, gets them out of there, and basically the fight then becomes those three characters from before fighting up against Chandler. It's fucking funny to even just say that. And Chandler is a fucking beast. He immediately is like microscopic and turns Diane not just normal-sized, but into a teeny tiny person. And she's also naked because obviously her armor doesn't fit
anymore.
Well,
yeah, her clothes shrunk off of her.
Duh. They try to do that. It's nighttime now because demons are strongest in night. And that also means it's when Escanar is at his absolute weakness. You can see him in bed and he's just like shriveled old man. So Escanar is no help right now. Merlin's no help because she's a child and maybe that also canceled her magic. If nothing else, she's just not involved in this fight. And it's the three of them trying to survive against this guy who immediately starts the fight by casting Meteor. He's just like, oh, Meteor!
Well, he also does something really important, which is that he makes sure that they are in the freaking dead of night so that Escanor is completely weak. So.
Yeah. So the just starts by casting Meteor that just starts fucking wrecking shop immediately. It even hits, I forget Hawk's big, like, the Mama Hawk one. Is it just called
Hawk Mama?
Mama. Okay, there you go. Even looks like it hits Hawk Mama a little bit there. But out of that rises King and Galther saying, I never guess I'd be combining powers with you. And we see the two of them are preparing for a big combo arrow attack, which kind of works but doesn't. Essentially, they fire it off first and use a fake arrow as an illusion for him to attack or to full counter, then a real arrow behind that, which hurts him but doesn't beat him, and he comes back and basically knocks away King. He just, like, sort of, like, King sees a bunch of, like, minor demons showing up, and he's like, oh, I'll just blast these guys away. And Gauthier's like, you stupid fucker! Because that gets full countered and just ravages King, and then he puts this hold, Chandler puts this hold mark on Gauthier, basically being like, I'm the highest ranking demon here, with your contract of darkness, you need to obey me, and stay out of this fight. And that's where Gowther is. He makes mention that if he tries to betray this mark, he'll basically be broken by the damage it'll do to him. Diane continues to, like, protect Elizabeth by using her heavy metal skill, turning her body into complete steel. So even though she's tiny, she's like a little tiny jumping naked shield, essentially.
Which is pretty cool.
And then Chandler is like, whoa, that technique of the giants where they turn their bodies into inorganic metal. I always got rid of it with this Crimson Requiem. Could I be any more scary? And he says, I'm going to melt you into soup. And there's just this wave of acid, I guess, that he like kind of like sends out at them, which would have killed them if not for Bond showing up and grabbing the characters. Yeah, that was a cool moment for Bond to show up. And he's just like, everyone keeps getting in my way. Fairies. And then it was giants. Who's it going to be this time? And he's like, a human, you got a problem with that? He's like, I have many problems with that, sir.
Yes. Yes, I do.
I have many problems. Will you just die already? But then he prepares another attack, and he finds that that arrow attack didn't just break the shield he was using. It also affected his spirit in a small way. So people are starting to fight back against him. But it's not enough to fully take him down, as we find out in this last chapter, as he's preparing his ultimate mega kind of like comeback super kill you all move. So he continues using
Exactly what it's called, in fact, yeah.
Yeah, he's using his Hatred Blade first, which I love. That's a great
Hatred name. Blade!
Chandler uses Hatred Blade. And he full counters essentially all the abilities that King's trying to use to defeat him. You know, he has this entire thing about like, yeah, Gowther, like, Hawk gets up and he's like, Gowther, let's make this old man pay. And that's when Gowther explains, like, I can't. If I try to, I'm going to die. So there's this great scene where Hawk runs up and starts trying to lick the seal mark off of Chandler's hand because that's what will, like, remove Gowther's imprisonment. And you just see Chandler staring like, what are you doing? Go away! And Hawk's like, it's my super secret move, licking the plate all clean.
I love Hawk.
And he just like, he just fucking slaps this pig with his cane. He's like, fuck off! It looks like everything's done for because, you know, even Hawk couldn't stand against the mighty Chandler. But Elizabeth uses her magic to like...
I'm sorry. The mighty Chandler.
The fiendish Chandler. Demon Lord. Elizabeth uses her magic to kind of like heal the characters.
Oh my god,
characters.
I feel so bad for anyone who hasn't ever watched Friends because that idea is just not the most hilarious.
So she heals all the characters. So King has one last chance to try to make a big critical attack, as we can see him preparing his legendary spear. But Chandler throws his attack, and he's like, "It's too late. Could you be any more late with your attack?" And then he's like, "Oh shit!" And he sees his attack missed, and he sees that there is that little dagger that's been placed into him from Gowther that he used it to redirect his hand and cause his attack to miss. And Gowther broke control just long enough, and that creates an opening that King uses to just impale Chandler with his spear and seemingly destroys him. We get one last shot of Chandler being like, "Master, could I be any more dead?" Poof, and just a puff of smoke. And our heroes are victorious, it seems. And those are the chapters. And, you know, in a way, it's kind of good, I guess, that Crunchyroll took 3 weeks. Because this is a very complete, like, 3 chapters to close together. And really great 3 chapters. This is an awesome fight. Like, I had to skip through a lot of it to kind of trim this down, but...
And a good way to use everyone who was present, basically.
Yeah, everyone gets a chance to shine in this. It's really...
Elizabeth, Bond...
Fucking Hawk!
Hawk, yeah.
It's great. Everyone gets their moment. It's a great fight between everybody there. And Chandler felt terrifying. Chandler felt like a big threat up to that level of being like, you're a new, 10 holy virtue or 10 commandments or whatever. So like it took what 5 of the deadly sins and Hawk to take him down or 4 of the deadly sins, I guess.
It depends on how you count them because
I count Merlin to a small
extent. 4 of them did the work, but Merlin was involved in the fight. So.
Yeah. So yeah, it took at least half of the seven deadly sins to take one guy down. So it puts you into scope of what's going to happen when the guy who's not named Chandler maybe has to go against them.
Things in Chandler's favor, being the man who trained Meliodas, an ancient demon lord who knows so many different skills, can use the amazing full counter to its full potential. Cons, named Chandler.
That's a bad name. So, yeah, that's seven deadly sins.
All right, from one fantasy series to the next, let us then go continuing on with Black Clover, the fight against...
Don't you mean Black Clover? We use the classic this time.
Page 129, the life of a certain man. Asta is pushed into a corner, trying to defend their crystal against Langris, and getting injured all the while, little chunks of him disappearing as Langris uses his spatial magic, and although Mimosa is right there behind him, healing him, she can't keep up. He's actually being injured faster than she can be healed. But Asta refuses to back down because he is Asta, and he's really, really fucking pissed off at Langris for what he did to Fenrir. And after a while, he says, okay, I've got to do this. You know, I can't even get into the black form because I can't get into that state. I can't hold a pose and make my key circulate. So under these circumstances, I can't do it. So Zerx, do it! And Zerx suddenly appears in front of Asta, as Asta gets ready in his pose, trying to get ready to enter his black form, and Zerx is going to defend him while he's doing this, although he's doing it a very Zerx way by saying, I'm not going to take orders from you, while taking orders from Asta. Oh, you so soon. And it's Zerx flashback backstory time, Chris.
This is a very important one to learn, and quite an interesting one.
So, the first thing we see in Zerx's backstory is not Zerx, but his father, who you can tell it's him because he's got the exact same hairstyle. The exact same hairstyle. Oh, none of the genes from mom, at least in the facial area.
His mom was just a mannequin face, like she had no facial features whatsoever.
And they say this guy's name at a certain point, Zara. Zara Ideal? Is that really his name? Or Ideale? It's spelled I-D-E-A-L-E. I have no idea what that is supposed to be pronounced as. That's not important. Zara / Zerx dad. And that Zerx's real name apparently is Zora. Just going to give a little pause there so that you can all get your Legends of Zelda jokes out of the way. Okay. So, basically, Zara was kind of that stereotypical, like, uncool dad kind of guy. Very kind of Rock Lee elements to him, honestly. He's very cheerful and energetic about everything. You know, he comes home to see his son. He's like, oh, you did the chores perfectly again today. Ha ha ha. Thanks for always helping me out. And apparently he would use his trap magic to pull pranks on Zora.
I fucking love it. I want to be a dad like fucking this dude where you're just digging trap holes for your kid to fall in and be like, ha 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 ha. This is a child abuse.
He uses it like a joy buzzer too. He's like, I had a trap seal in my hand. Ah!
Like, there's one scene of like his son walking by and a glyph like firing off a fireball in front of him, like that feels really dangerous. Like, I'm sure it's all fun. You probably made sure it couldn't possibly. That still looks dangerous from far away.
And one day he gave little Zora a little doll / action figure thing that he made for him. The Envoy of Justice, Super Magic Knight Zora, who is very clearly the base for current Zerx's appearance, complete with the, you know, binding around the mouth that exposes sharp teeth. I want to believe that Zora didn't get so into the idea of being this, matching the appearance of this doll that he like filed his teeth down just to match it.
Yeah, I wonder, how did he get the shark teeth?
So Zora's just like, what the hell is this? And he's like, I made it for you. It's Super Magic Knight Zora. He's, you know, he's got a bit of a mouth on him, but he's as good as his word. A warrior who protects the country behind the scenes. And he's like, you know, I'm 12 already, Dad. It's like, and Zara says something kind of cool, which is, I'm not saying you have to match this. I just think you should talk a little more, you know, communicate with others. You know, just like, hey, you know, look at how cool this guy that I made for you is. And, you know, if you'd be a little bit more like him, you might be a little bit happier. So, and then he's like, I'm off to protect the peace again. And so, you know, despite the fact that he's, you know, this kind of irritating guy for a 12-year-old kid, Zara says, I was proud of my dad. The first peasant to be a magic knight. Ooh. He flunked the test lots of times before he made it, but every time he worked so incredibly hard that it dazzled me. And every time that he came home, apparently Zara was all super cheerful about everything. I fought alongside an amazing guy today. The guy's like that 60 in the world. I can't believe I get to protect the country with those amazing people. And I'm going to use all the power I got to protect everything I can protect too. That's what magic knights do. Next panel, gravestone.
And it's not like, how are you going to protect anything when you're dead?
Sad. But it's all Halloween themed, guys. Look, a tombstone.
And there's a super spooky tree next to him.
There's also some really creepy looking silhouettes also.
Bless you. I love this chapter for a lot of reasons, but I hate Black Clover's way of casting villains because everyone is so absurdly evil. It's not just that these guys state clearly that his dad died. They killed him. And the reason they killed him was because he was a peasant trash. And I could get the idea of elitism. Like playing into this, like they're like, we don't want a commoner amongst us. Like it's just prejudice at its core. And it's a dark and heinous thing. But they're so like evil and shit to this. They're just like, that's why you got nailed and backed by a comrade. You're like, that's kind of dark. And they're like, I can't believe that guy buzzing around talking about helping civilians near death. Nobody wants a shabby magic knight like you. I'm like, what do they think magic knights are at this point? Then like, they're like, look at this guy doing a job.
Yeah, you know, it is our own special club for only the most elite of people. Only those that come from the right kind of fiber are suited to be among us. Stupid black, peasants can't join us.
Just like, you don't become a magic knight to save people. You become a magic knight so you can get invited to all the charcuterie parties that it's bestowed upon us, you peasant. If you're trying to save people, that means there's less charcuterie for everybody else.
This was an interesting chapter for me because it revisited this whole, you know, elitism among the elites. And I'm in two minds about it now at this point, I will say. I still hold on to that whole, but at the same time, I think that we have to acknowledge at this point that the classism in Black Clover is not just like a backdrop that, you know, is a vehicle for showing how special mostly Asta and Yuno are, but also, it is just a theme of the series, and it's something that really gets pushed and is important. And I get the feeling that this is going to be central to some sort of conflict or change within the series at some point. I really find it hard to believe at this point that it's not just going to be just a thing in this world, but it is going to be a very important thing that is going to be relevant to the plot and not just characters' backstories. So I am there with you in terms of the whole just the most ham-fistedly douchebag evil about this, and I think it would have been far more effective at this point if instead of coming to the guy's grave in order to laugh at him, because it's just these two guys who are just... Oh, wait. Hang on a second. Yeah, they just go and visit his grave just to be like, look at this asshole.
Yeah.
A couple of days.
Like, not just to be like, he's an asshole. They're like, man, I hope he died with regrets. I bet he did. I bet he was super sad when he died. I bet he left behind a family. High five, high five, high five, high five, and then leave.
I think it would have been far more effective if instead of literally Zora walking away from his dad's grave and then looking over his shoulders like, I bet that little peasant was his fucking ugly kid. that imagine if instead, you know, after visiting his dad's grave, we see him later on trying to make his way in the world without parents. My God. And he hears instead, say, some purple orcas in a bar getting drunk and being loose mouths and be like, yeah, that guy was such a prick getting in thinking that he could hang with us. So, you know, I'm not proud of what I did, but I don't regret having to shoot the guy in the back. You know, just present things in a different context than every single time you see this elitism take place, with the exception of specific characters. They don't even have faces like these guys.
It's weird, too, because you brought up a bar, and that's literally where the next scene goes, is a bunch of, like, drunk guys try to harass this, like, bartender woman, and they try to, like, start stripping her with their magic, and he shows up and kicks the shit out of them, and this is kind of the catalyst for where we see, like, why Xerx became the way he did, you know, why he goes after people, because he's so hateful of these people who are magic knights and hold these high ranks, and they're just the scumbags of the world. And you're like, okay, I get it. Why didn't you just do the two combinations of them where he overhears these two knights talking about what they did to his dad, and he gets vengeance for them there? And because you said,
and that puts him down the road, and that's where he, you know, gets his worldview. Just put these two scenes together. Exactly.
It's not even like those two characters, like those two guys are, as you said, faceless. They might never show up again. It's just like, it's weird. And I know this is thing that the purple orcas are almost this like earnestly evil, like magic knight group now in the series. Cause they've had like three distinct instances of being like villainous now between the one zombie dude from early on. Then they had like, oh, your one captain was a shithead, and now this.
And also, establishing that real Xerx actually is a complete and utter douchebag, and we didn't actually see all of that scene before this.
So it's like, now we really know that the Purple Orcas are just this fuckhead of a group. Like, it just feels like you could have, like, swapped this around. Now, I don't want that to undercut the fact that I think this is an extremely effective backstory. Oh, yeah. I love it. I just want to note that, like, there's a very complicated world in the Magic Knight system and elitism in this world that at some point I feel like I need to like really discuss in like a video or something, because it's it's interesting to talk about, but it's so much to it you really can't fit it in every week, and I feel like we try to.
And so yeah, we see, you know, I guess the first time that I'm gonna hold off on calling him Zora in his current form until we actually like have him stop everyone calling him Xerx. Because it's going to be weird for them to say Xerx and while we're calling him Zora for a bit. So just put up with that for the time being, guys. I'll give you a warning there. We see, you know, Xerx and, you know, take on this form and, you know, be these guys in the bar, encounter the real Xerx. And after he was harassing a grandma who was taken away by the Purple Orcas for some reason and was begging to have her back. What?
It would have been so much like weird, like easier to just have been like bandits or kidnappers took my, like bad people took my child. Can you please get them, like get my grandchild back? And you can still just have the fucking dude be like, did you see this magic knight, his child, you peasant? But yeah.
Take her away. What? Are they participating in slave trade too? On top of everything else? This is something that Internal Affairs really needs to take a look at, guys.
They're just like, guys, William Vengeance told us there's no evil things going on. Stop looking into them. He said there was a body we found and it had a note on it that said, I don't want any autopsies on it. Signed, William Vengeance, scribbled off person who's dead. So obviously he doesn't want any autopsies. It's fine. Just stop looking into these things.
Okay. So in the present, Xerx shouts at Langris, you people aren't magic knights, while thinking privately, you aren't the magic knights of my father's dreams. And yeah, I mean, to lead up to this, yeah, I get it. I get the resentment that he holds towards magic knights. I get why he frowns so much on elitism now. Yeah, cool. And but also in a way, you know, to give credit to him, he didn't become, you know, this like dark figure bent on vengeance. He became the figure that his father wanted in the world, because he's not just going around taking out random Imaginites. He joined this test group in order to help people, and he's that mysterious figure supporting the kingdom from the shadows that his father, you know, says like, oh, yeah, he's this, you know, so he's doing good in the world too. So good anti-hero. Good job.
I'll be curious to see what happens in the next couple chapters with Asta. I think this is one of the few characters who I'm like really legitimately like, I hope Asta helps this guy get on the best path possible. And I'd love to see this guy join the Black Bulls or something like that. Like, it feels like
he'd fit right in, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
So Zerx has his trap seal shield in front of him to defend Asta. Langris has his swarm of projectiles going towards him, and they all jump around the shield. And Langris just says, I'm the real Magic Knight. And they impact into Zerx all over, triggering a trap seal on his body. And Zerx says, that's the first attack to hit me today. Congrats, aristocrats. And Wizard King assistant person is like, he drew a magic circle on his body. That's like being constantly attacked by your own magic. The risk must be enormous. I don't quite get that, but okay.
Sure.
We don't really get how magic circles work in this world. But all right, yes, I guess it's a burden in order to get... Okay, fine. And so, and in a flashback, he remembers, you know, people asking him, what are you? Who are you? And he thinks to himself, I'm nobody. I was born from a dirty little brat in a peasant village, and I am Hopeless Rage Incarnate! And all of the projectiles Langris launched at him go flying out everywhere.
Super dope.
Yeah. So, yeah. Love Zerx. Cool.
All right. Let's wrap up this week then by discussing We Never Learn, Chapter 35. A genius secretly has to accept whether or not he has to give someone else a free pizza. Because
we'll
that is the chapter this week. I'm skipping over 90% of this fucking chapter. It's an Iruka and Uega chapter. Essentially, they're both very nervous. There's a scene where both of them individually go up to Fumino and discuss things with her. By the way, there's a scene also where Fumino does the drinking glass thing, but she does it with one hand, which is
how
scientific.
Is she holding it?
It's like, hey guys, I'm doing this. Like, but you don't see her thumb underneath.
I'm drawing a conclusion right here. Okay, I think that I'm going to, you know, make my case, and then I'm going to open up the manila envelope on the clue board. And if I'm wrong, then I lose. I don't think that Taishi Tsutsui knows how to draw hands holding a glass properly.
Like, he tries to draw it, and there's always like, it's like, all right, first finger, second finger. Ah, what are these ones doing? No! But they both have conversations with Fumino that are essentially like, so my friend likes this girl and knows these things, or my friend kind of has this thing with this boy, but it's getting kind of weird. They both just are to explain their situation to Fumino, who's obviously smart to be like, you both like each other. I know you're lying, but she tries to help them out anyway. So she basically encourages both of them to hang out together.
Well, hang on. I want to point out that Uega doesn't use the language of my friend has a crush on. He just says, oh yeah, he did all this stuff to make things more awkward between them. So, there you go.
Yeah. So, she basically arranges that the two of them are going to, like, meet out together, like, just hang out and have a conversation. She's going to be that 80s movie character who's going to be, like, feeding them info, like, through the side to help them get through their date. But this
also, there's a joke about her disguises that she's wearing like 5 bras to make her breasts look bigger, and apparently this is super effective.
Yeah, she was wearing 6 bra pads, and everyone's like, is that Fumino? And they just look at the chest like, can't be her. And like, I like her response where she's mortified, but she's like, I'll get you tomorrow. But she's trying to text them, and she keeps bringing up things like, hey, why don't you ask him about, like, a mutual friend? And they start talking about a mutual friend, and every time it brings up more sexually awkward scenes between them. They're like, hey, remember that time we went to Ashwi's place and it was raining? She's like, did you see my bra? He's like, and everything just keeps going that way. It's like, oh, hey, bring out, you know, going to a shrine. She's like, oh, yeah. Oh, and then there's that time I saw you, like, laying down the shrine and your body was all exposed. Oh, God. Like, it just keeps happening over and over. And then Shikijo texts her because Shikijo is asking, hey, which hairdo do you think Rizu Ogata would like more? The updo is sexier, but, and there's two images she sent along, a ponytail shot and a high ponytail. And she's got little hearts and everything around them. And I love Fumino's response is, who cares? Cause she's like, I've got so much more going on. But all this is happening while there's just this big conversation going on, and the, you know, Uruka and Uega are kind of like just trying to figure things out. Uruka's thinking like, I just want things, like, Uega's such a good guy. He wants to, I want things to kind of go back normal. And it'd be nice if he thought I was cute. That would really make me happy though. So that's happening. And Fumino is trying to respond to these texts. And she's hitting them out, and she's like, yeah, that's great. Fine. Sakijo, the cuter hairstyle. That's fine. Whatever. And boom. And then she's like, oh shit. I sent the wrong text to the wrong person. And Uega got the one about the cute hairstyle. So he says, oh, that hairstyle looks good on you. It's cute. And Aruka's like, what'd you say? He's like, it's cute. Say it again. It's cute. One more time. He's like, this is weird now. But she keeps making him say like, it's cute. And all of a sudden, all of the attention just completely vanished, and they have a real honest conversation. And there's a scene later on where Uega goes to school and he's thanking, Fumino for everything. And he notices that she has a ponytail. She keeps like twirling it and everything like that, like just over and over again. And he's just like, what's up? She's like, God damn it, fuckhead, call it cute, dickhead. Like, how can you not pick up on these signs yet?
No, hang on. Let's be fair about this. Because, as we will establish later on, Chris is kind of just sees things that he wants to see. Because Fumino is twirling her hair, and Uega starts to react. But before he can actually properly react to it, suddenly Ogata bursts in and is like, I'm broke! So, we don't see where that actually goes. But the only thing that I think you can...
No, it's not what happens.
It says,
She's doing that. She's twirling her hair, and Uega says, oh, I'm sorry. I'm broke. So standing room udon only. And she's like, I'm not asking for a reward. Call me cute fucko. But she doesn't say the last part.
I thought that was Ogata's hair.
Oh, it seems like maybe we're not reading
Ogata's
everything.
Ogata's not there
clearly.
Because she's with Sekijo. That's right.
Exactly. As we get to the end of this.
Why don't you talk about that, Chris?
Yeah, we get to this. I do want to talk about this. So we find out because she sent the ponytail text message to Uega, the text message she meant to send to Uega about clearing up misunderstandings was sent to Sekijo instead. So Sekijo shows up to Ogata and says, it's important to, the text message, it's important to clear up misunderstanding about liking someone else. Express your honest feelings and then you can be friends. So you see Sekijo and she's like panting and blushing. She's like, it seems there's been some kind of misunderstanding. I don't have a crush on anyone, Rizu Ogata. So can we be friends? And, Ogata's just like, whatever, sure. And, the chapter just ends with the text of like, thanks to, Fumino Furuhashi's mistext, a friendship was born. So, Nick is choosing to read into this that the literal translation of this is that Sekijo doesn't have a crush on her, that it was just a desire for friendship and everything else like that. We know it's not the case. I think Nick knows that's not the case. He's choosing to ignore it. Now this scene, right here, this last panel, one, it's a joke. It's a joke at the end of the chapter sort of thing. Like every other chapter of this series has, like the last chapter where fucking Kirisu Senpai's like, you're so good at breathing and walking upright like a human. This one's here for a joke because it's about how Sekijo is not actually being honest with their feelings. Case in point number one, this scene's actually a juxtaposition to the fact of how Uruka felt earlier in this chapter where she was like,
yeah, juxtaposition as a parallel.
Parallel. Symmetry. Whatever you want to call it. The fact of the matter is, it's obviously referencing the same fact that Uruka was like, it would be great if we could just be friends and he'd occasionally call me cute sometimes, ignoring the fact that she does still have feelings for him as Sekijo still has feelings for Ogata.
Is that, you done?
I'm starting here. You can continue.
Oh, you're getting started. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
No. Feel free. I want to hear your response. All right. I want to hear how you were trying to refuse a free pizza.
Well, okay. Let's start with your point about the last panel being a joke, but the first panel not being a joke. When, as you established, that same panel ends with Fumino doing one of the funniest moments in the chapter where she goes, who cares? So, I don't think that you really have much to go on in that case. Now, in terms of the use of the two relationships to parallel one another, I think that you're onto something there, and I'm not going to deny that that is the purpose of them. However, I believe that that alone, well, evidence of a interest in a sexual relationship is not proof. Okay?
Do I need this fucking manga to show Shikija just being like, I want to fuck you, Rizo Ogata, before I get my free pizza?
When we first made this bet, I basically told you that there had to be solid evidence that she was romantically interested in her. I could point out a number of cases where they hint of that being probably the case, such as with Soifon and Yoruichi in Bleach, where you never really understood exactly what Soifon's interest in Yoruichi was, but it did definitely come off as a romantic interest a few times, but it was never confirmed.
So we've had, just in quick memory, we've had the moment in this chapter with the ponytail and asking which one she thinks Rizu Ogata would think would be cuter. We had the scene a previous couple weeks ago where she was at a movie, a romantic movie, thinking about how it would be so great to take Rizu along to go see this. These aren't clues adding up to a collective. Does it need to be one chapter that includes all these ones together before we get there?
Okay. I established one of the more recent times that we talked about this that I'm going to lose this bet. I have no illusions about that. At the same time, however, I think that you're basically calling the game after three quarters because you're up 24 points. All right.
And Nick, the Giants are not going to lose. They're up 21 points. All right. They can't lose.
The Bucks
lose.
Are going to win. Rondé Barber just returned Peyton Manning's interception for a touchdown. We've got to win. So let's basically not put the cart before the horse on this case is what I'm saying. I really do not believe that if you entered into this chapter thinking of the relationship between Seikijo and Ogata, that this does anything to actually confirm it more. If anything, that first panel is one step forward and the last panel takes it right back, because you basically have to go from saying Seikijo is very interested in having a friendship with Ogata because she's interested in her in a way that she doesn't really understand because she's not being honest with herself because of the fact that she has a crush on her, and you can only really do that by reading into the subtext of the series at this point, and then you have to say the same thing after this chapter, because yes, Seikijo says which of these haircuts is more attractive because she's weirdly obsessed with being Ogata's friend. Then at the end of the chapter, she flat out says and is excited about being friends with Ogata. Is important. Because everyone points out, oh, well, she brings up, though, that she doesn't have a crush on anyone. But she only says that because Fumino specifically told her, clear the misunderstanding about liking someone else.
So one thing. Look, I want to be friends with Liam Neeson. I'm not going to text people, hey, I want to be friends with Liam Neeson. Which haircut do you think Liam Neeson's going to find sexier?
Well, she doesn't say that specifically.
Yes, she does. Which one is sexier, but...
Right. So the other one has things that are nice about it that aren't just sexy.
Okay. So we're cutting off the text there. But secondly.
Okay.
I want my free goddamn pizza.
So your argument has gone from, you are wrong, therefore I win the bet about the pizza, to, I want the pizza.
My argument is that we're already 10 minutes over our limit for the podcast, so I can't go too much longer. But yes, my argument is I want my pizza, damn it. With all the spookiest toppings.
And honestly, guys, all y'all who this half week or so since Chris tweeted me that picture, that worse than mine photoshopped picture from the series as evidence, and jumped on it and said, you're wrong, Nick. Chris is right. Give him this free pizza. Don't you really actually want deep down for this to go on longer? Because isn't this what you actually want? If we reach the point where I give Chris the free pizza, then I'll have given him the free pizza. don't you actually want my suffering to be prolonged where I have to think about eventually giving Chris the free pizza? I'm not going to give him another free pizza after he gets this one for the same bet.
It's about the chase. Once it's over, there's nothing. Exactly. We need this to build.
You guys aren't getting a free pizza. Chris is.
We need this to build up to the point where you can do a Daniel Bryan monster style promo video on it. Like, I'm just like, the fans want this, Nick. They know it's about the pizza. And a bunch of fans be like, no, pizza, pizza, pizza. And you come in, you're like,
a free pizza, but only if.
And then you show up and you kick me and you pedigree me into the floor. You're like, no! Free pizzas!
No! 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 No!
Oh, and on that so note,
thank you everyone for joining us for Whiskey Monger Recap. We record the show normally on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, but sometimes we have to change our plans, and the best way to stay updated on those changes is to follow us on social media. Our Twitter accounts for the official podcast are at WMR Podcast, and your hosts are at Rulo T and at Y Ruler of Time. Follow us. Occasionally, Chris sends me pictures, photoshopped pictures of We Never Learn, where he proves how wrong he is. And there's other stuff that we get up to on there. Anyway, beyond that, I think that I'm going to just go ahead and name the recommendation that we're going to be taking on for next time. I don't know if we'll actually finish this in time for Halloween month. So I think that we might just kind of like cut it short because I don't want us to be ending Halloween month in November. So just to let you know. But anyway, the series that we're going to be talking about is School Live, which is a manga that's been suggested a couple of different times. It looks very cutesy, but I have, according to Wikipedia, it's a survival horror manga. I don't have any idea about it. It's relatively popular and is still ongoing, so there's actually no way we can actually finish it.
It's
so,
about surviving the horror of having a bad hair day. I'm like, I should have known. <That's> Produced by Nickelodeon.
And anyway, Sekijo's already found the solution to that, so we're good. I've completely lost my place here. Thank you, everybody, for supporting us. You can check out our past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com if you want to listen to all of our other past conversations about whether or not Sekijo has a lesbian crush on Ogata and a myriad of other things. Subscribe to us on iTunes as well. Leave a comment and rating to help us beat the woodworkers and become king of the hobby section on iTunes. Or you can also do that on YouTube, too. YouTube recommendations are nice. Yes. Feedback, questions, suggestions for future manga for us to read can all be sent to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. This School Live is going to be the last Halloween recommendation that we're going to be taking, so it's going to be back to normal stuff. Yeah, you're going to have to hold off on specifically Halloween recommendations until next year. Well, you don't have to actually hold them off. We might take a look at them anyway. Whatever. Special thanks go out to our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy. Pardon me. Such as the commentary that we did last week on Neo-Yokio. Which apparently, according to Chris, we're going to do again.
I think so. We should finish off the series. It's 6 episodes. I want it out of my Netflix queue. I really should have just led with that. Nick, I can't stand shit in my Netflix queue. Oh, do we have to do our MVP still?
Yes, we do. Let me just get this out of the way. Special thanks to Steve Anderson Talkadars. You can check out his work in a bunch of different places. He drew the clear red field in a bikini picture that you see up here. You can see he's got his own Patreon, and if you go on there, he has all of the Weekly Manga Recap title cards for free, as well as some other stuff that he does that's not safe for work if you want to become a patron of his. And finally, special thanks to Infamous Planet. Let's get into our favorites for this week. Favorite series to start things off with. You go first.
Yeah. I'm going to go with Dr. Stone. I originally went into this thinking Black Clover, but upon reading it, I realized I had a little more issues with it than I thought. But I still just love what the Dr. Stone chapter did, giving us so much more extra context for these characters, giving us a great relationship about some stuff, and then just really kind of showing off a couple elements I thought were really cool between these characters. Just great all around.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to say the same. Food Wars is, you know, in an in-between kind of area, and it had a weird fan service bit that kind of threw me off. My Hero Academia, we had issues with in terms of the pacing and stuff. Black Clover, we went over that. And Promised Neverland is more just kind of leading into something else. out of all the rest of them, I think that We Never Learn was probably the best remaining. Well, aside from Seven Deadly Sins with the three chapters, which I think we have to call a handicap. So issues with almost everything. It was a good week overall, but I agree that Dr. Stone was overall from beginning to end all the way through the strongest and cool Kohaku background stuff.
Yes. Character, I'm going to be giving to Zerk slash Zor, whatever we want to call him. This was a great, like, backstory chapter for him. Adds a lot of context to that character. Just makes him a cool new added element to that series.
I had considered giving it to Mitsuki just for that one little moment where he talks with Boruto and shows that he can be a persuasive guy who understands his friends really well. But you gotta give it to Zerks. Just a really really well done backstory that we've seen so far. And I think the most effective probably that we've seen from this series. And there have been some good ones here and there. So, yeah, total agreement from us this week. But I think that the favorites between us were just obvious. So,
yeppers.
And that is gonna do it. Next time, then, we will have as much of School Live done as we can. And that's gonna do it. We will see you guys on the last Weekly Manga Recap before Halloween. Anything?
But, Nick!
Chris?
Don't you mean on the next Weekly Manga Bookcap?
Gonna end on a high note, huh?
On the highest of notes. From the motherfucking mountaintops!
Okay.
99 points! A new record! Ah, 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 ah!